And just remind everyone here that the goal of the DC HWS platform is to facilitate open and frank information exchange among professionals in both the public and private sectors. They offer a variety of forums for presentations describing current practices and approaches in the areas of hazardous waste design and construction. This also enhances communication networks amongst our stakeholders that are involved in site cleanup. Now, we do have a fantastic turnout for this session. We've had over 415 registrations. I continue to get daily requests for more people to join. And you'll see by the chart here that a large sector is coming from the federal government. We also have state regulators and then members of the AEC community, as well as some other participants, such as members of academia. There are nearly 90 SAMI members who have registered to participate in almost, pardon me, 118 young professionals. Geographically, we also have a nice distribution. Again, we've been happy to see the wide geographic spread of participants, including two international attendees, that's helping to ensure that the DCHWS message is reaching a broad audience. Now, for today's agenda, this, again, is our final day, and April Fool's, it's not really April 2nd, it's April 1st, but for here on day three of the agenda, we'll be starting with our opening remarks, just as we have with the others in the symposium. Then we'll move on to panel number five, where the topic will be improving stakeholder collaboration, looking at a few case studies. We'll take another break today, and during that break, you'll be able to enjoy a word from some of our event sponsors, before we then move on to our final event in the symposium, and that's our Young Professional event, where we'll look at moving up to project management. At the very end, I'll come back on the line for closing remarks. And again, for those of you who have questions about PDHs, I'll be talking about those at the very end today. Now, our panel format typically involves a moderator with three panelists, and our panelists will be providing short 20-minute technical presentations with time for facilitated Q&A at the end of these presentations. Now, as I noted earlier, you all have that Q&A window. You can use it at any time in the lower right to send your questions and comments in. And I do not want you all to wait to those question breaks. Send them in as soon as they occur to you, and then our moderators will try to get through as many as they can in the time that we have allotted today. All right, I did want to be sure to thank the DCHWS Symposium Committee and our event sponsors, EPA and their Office of Superfund Remediation and Technology Innovation, and then SAMI's Philadelphia Post and their DCHWS Committee. We do want to thank our event sponsors. Without their support, our event would not have been possible. We also have large business sponsors as well as small business sponsors who have helped to support the virtual symposium. Now, with those brief overviews to the virtual symposium, and I've had an opportunity here to scroll through some of the dialogue that has been taking place with our virtual participants here about the things that you have enjoyed in the virtual symposium. This has been great to see that input. I'm going to go ahead and shrink things down here on the screen and close out that opportunity. And it's going to be my distinct pleasure to introduce you to today's plenary speaker, Rick Weiss. Rick is the chair of SAMI's Environmental Community of Interest. He's a professional geologist and senior geologist, as well as a project manager for Battelle. He spent 35 years of experience in the development, implementation, and management of site remedial investigations, compliance, and remediation projects. He's focused specifically on DOD clients and has technical work involved in the development and application of innovative chlorinated solvent groundwater remediation and DNEPL management approaches. He also has been involved in PFAS remedial investigations and remediation technology development. Mr. Weiss is also currently serving as an instructor for the Civil and Engineering Department in the graduate level remediation engineering class at Carnegie Mellon University. And as noted before, he is part of SAMI as the chair for their Environmental Community of Interest. So with that, I'm going to go ahead and turn it over to you, Rick, to share your opening remarks.
Okay, thank you, Jean. I hope you can hear me. I'm a little bit
nervous. I can.
Great, super. So welcome, everybody. It's an honor to be addressing this audience because the DCHWS conference is exactly what our mission is at SAMI. We've developed a, So our mission basically is to encourage and support the interchange of ideas between industry and government, and this conference is a gold standard for that collaboration. We try to bring people together to solve the challenges of the environmental area within the ECII and help the architect, engineering, and construction community meet our national security needs. So the mission statement is exactly what this conference is about, and it's like really exciting to see the Philadelphia Post and EPA collaborate for these many years, advancing the collaboration between industry and government. So exactly what the EC, well, before I say that, there's other communities of interest in SAMI include the International Group, a Leadership Development Group, an Architecture Group, a Resiliency Group, Energy and Sustainability COI, a Facilities Management COI, and we recognize the important need for STEM. So we also have a STEM COI and an engineering camps. SAMI sponsors through the Marines, Air Force, and the Army, and the Navy, through their engineering commands, summer camps for high school students to go and learn what it's about to be an engineer. So STEM is really important. We also recognize the need for young professionals to be interacting with more seasoned folks and develop their skills and their networking. So that's another COI that's very, very important to us, SAMI, is the Young Professionals COI. And I see a lot of young professionals attending this conference, which is great. In terms of the environmental COI, we have a steering committee which tries to capture the main focus areas that we're involved in. We're all volunteers. We have a cross-section of government as well as architect and engineering folks involved. And we deal with webinars as one of our major outreach forums for exchanging information. We sponsor quite a few webinars, and as do the other COIs. So in my closing remarks, I'll get that again. And then we have the Joint Engineering Training Conference called JETSE. This is an annual event. It's being held virtually this year, and hopefully next year we'll all be together. It gets several thousand attendees, and it's an overview of all the different COIs at SAMI, as well as SAMI business, and some really super keynote speakers many of them are from interesting past military experience. And we also get to interact with some of the higher ranks in the engineering community in the Department of Defense, as well as the Veterans Affairs is involved, the U.S. Coast Guard, and the Public Health Service. They also get involved in the JETSE, as well as in SAMI. We also have a co-chair for Analytical Services. If you don't have the data, you can't make the decision. So we look at Analytical Services as a really important area. And probably the biggest area we've had involvement in is emerging issues, which means the PFAS issue, as well as other emerging contaminants like 1,4-dioxane. We also have a focus on remediation, in-situ remediation, new techniques. We recently had a webinar on horizontal wells. And not to be too remediation-oriented, which is my background, we also have NEPA and compliance co-chairs. And our focus is outreach, so we have several folks in our committee who reach out through social media, as well as we develop a network of ECOI members to adapt a post and liaison with various posts. So we're using social media also. Our webinars cover a wide range of topics, and I'll give a breakdown of those in a minute. We also have a monthly call. It's the third Wednesday of the month from 1500 to 1600 hours Eastern. We usually try to start off with a 5 to 10 minute presentation of a technical issue or even a vendor and what their skills are. It's not advertising, but it gives folks a chance to really reach out and tell us what they do. We also review the JETSE abstracts. We get anywhere from 30 to 40 abstracts. We review those, and we select them for the presentation at the conference, as well as we look at some of those abstracts, and if they don't make the cut for the conference, we welcome those submitters to maybe do a webinar. We've also started with the liaison program with posts, having posts contact us and saying, hey, we need a speaker, or what can we do to address PFAS or climate change issues? Who do you know? So within our community, we'll reach out, and if it's an area that's not within our community, we'll collaborate with the other communities like resilience, energy, and sustainability. And recently, SAMI started a health engineering task force, which is kind of neat because it's not just occupational health, it's also environmental health. So it really is an umbrella that ties in many of the COIs together. One of the other things we've instituted recently is having liaisons amongst the COIs. Resiliency issues in terms of climate change and facilities also have a major impact on site compliance and remediation. So there's a lot of crossover and dialogue between the two. And the same with energy and sustainability. We've had some presentations on sustainable remediation in the past. So there's a lot of crosstalk amongst the COIs. We also have meetings at the Small Business Conference meeting, and at the JETSE, we have a committee meeting. We set aside an hour or so to meet in person, or at least in the current way we're doing things, on the same website at the same time. The webinar, as I mentioned, this is probably one of the biggest things that we do to reach out to folks. We've had several PFAS webinars. We've had a couple of webinars on NEPA. We recently had a webinar on 1,4-dioxane, and last fall we had a webinar on COVID and wastewater, how to look at wastewater as an indicator for COVID contamination. And our most recent webinar was a presentation by a vendor on horizontal wells for remediation. And we get anywhere from 30 to 120 folks on webinars. The PFAS has had a little bit more attendance than others. And our next webinar coming up in April is going to be the United States Army Corps of Engineers Engineering and Research Center presenting what they do in the environmental workspace. So once again, for this information, it's not hard to find. You go to SAMI.org, look at Become Involved tab, Communities of Interest, and the environmental COI is there, as well as the other COIs that are available for members to participate in. And if you have any specific questions, please feel free to email me directly. It's not a hard email. It's weice@battelle.org. You can reach me either, you know, if you go to the COI subpage on the SAMI website, my email is there, and we welcome everybody. And if you have an idea for a webinar, that's another thing we welcome your reaching out to us for. We can help arrange a webinar for you through the National SAMI Network. So with that, Gene, I think I've covered it, and I appreciate the opportunity once again. And I guess this is really more than a gold standard. This is really the platinum standard for the government and EPA and SAMI interaction. Thank you.
All right. Thank you so very much, Rick. I appreciate those words, and I'm seeing lots of comments coming in from people appreciating the remarks. So thank you very, very much. Let's go ahead and move on with our day, and I'll encourage our audience to go ahead and chime into that Q&A window and let me know if you can, if you're ready to go. You can type in a virtual round of applause for panel number 5 if you like, as I'm introducing them. So it is also my distinct pleasure to introduce you to your moderator for panel number 5 today. We're being joined today by Todd Bragdon from CDM Smith. He is a vice president and federal client service leader with 25 years of engineering experience in project management, environmental investigation, and remediation. Mr. Bragdon is a professional engineer with remediation experience, including abandoned mine environmental assessment and cleanup projects for various government clients, including the state of Colorado and the U.S. EPA in regions 6, 8, and 10. His responsibilities include directing projects that evaluate and select sufficient and cost-effective remedial technologies, pilot testing design and implementation, and designing, permitting, and providing construction management support for various remedial actions. He has a BS in civil engineering from the University of Colorado and an MS in civil environmental engineering from the University of Cincinnati. And so with that, Todd, it is again my pleasure to introduce you, and I'm going to turn things over to you.
Thanks, Gene. Well, welcome everyone to our third day of the DCHWS conference. As Gene mentioned, I'm Todd Bragdon, and I'm a vice president with CDM Smith in Denver. I work primarily with our federal EPA Superfund team. Well, it's a pleasure to be the moderator for panel 5. Our panel today will focus on the need to consider and improve stakeholder collaboration during remedial design and remedial action projects. I'm sure many of you have faced challenges with coordinating and managing multiple stakeholders during project execution. Stakeholder interests can be varied and include technical, regulatory, and other intangible challenges such as environmental justice issues. How you manage your stakeholder interests and concerns can be a critical success factor for Superfund projects. And there are multiple agencies, including redevelopment, reuse parties, active and concerned communities can all be important stakeholders to collaborate through project execution. And you're going to hear how some of our panelists today have some fantastic case studies on how they coordinated with and successfully executed projects with multiple stakeholders. So to get us started, Gene has a couple of polling opportunities for us to kind of prime the pump and get our engagement going. So if you would, please take a look at the polling questions. So the first one is, what are the biggest impacts to your projects related to stakeholder communication issues? There's a few options there for you. Again, we'd love for you to participate and let us know some of the challenges that you've had. Our second polling question is more of a whiteboard crowdsourcing question. Again, it's open, and please feel free to put that in as well. But we're looking for you to tell us about your biggest challenges with stakeholders. Looks like many of you have faced challenges before with stakeholders regarding scope. Again, as many of you all can see, the various interests from stakeholders can really challenge project teams with technical needs that you may not have encountered before, or regulatory requirements from a local or state perspective that perhaps, you weren't anticipating. I like the polling technology, Gene, by the way. Nice work.
Thank you. And I'll just remind my participants very quickly. Remember, if you've gone full screen, you want to escape out of the full screen so you can see them. For those of you on mobile devices, you need to click over to the poll window to open them up. And then for my friendly presenters in the background, you do not want to touch those polls. You want to leave them small so the audience can answer them. All right, Todd, go ahead.
Thanks, Sue. And again, I appreciate everyone being active on the polls and engaging. Appreciate the feedback here about educating stakeholders to ensure they understand the project and issues. And again, that's a very common challenge that I think many of us have faced, is that many of these stakeholders may not be familiar with the CERCLA process. They may have different concerns that perhaps have been an issue for a long time regarding their concerns on the project area or other concerns within their communities. And it is important to have an open and educating discussion with stakeholders, both from the program's perspective and the requirements of the program and what the program can and cannot do, versus some of their concerns. So appreciate mentioning that. Well, Gene, let's move on. Gene's already covered the rules of the road once, but let me just mention it again. We very much want your engagement. The panel this afternoon will consist of three presentations that will each discuss a case study regarding improving stakeholder collaboration. Following the panelists' presentations, we'll have a moderated question and answer period that I'll lead. Again, we want you to please feel free to ask questions at any time using the Q&A toolbar. We will be monitoring and collecting your questions to address them during the moderated Q&A period at the end of the three presentations. So again, we encourage you to be active and please ask questions. We appreciate your active collaboration with us. So with that, let me begin by introducing our first panelist and presentation. Our first speaker is Mr. David Russell. David is a senior program director with AECOM in the Philadelphia area. He has over 40 years of experience in wastewater engineering, hazardous waste site characterization, wastewater and hazardous waste sampling and monitoring, innovative and alternative treatment technologies, design build for soil and groundwater remediation, and environmental compliance and permitting. He serves as a remediation area leader in AECOM's Northeast region. David's presentation today is titled Application of Multiple Remedial Techniques and Approaches at a Former Pharmaceutical Manufacturing Facility. Please welcome David.
Unfortunately, it's the wrong presentation. It's up. There we go. Good afternoon, everyone. I'm really excited today to present to you a true brownfield success story. You know, often our goals in remediation are to remediate a site to the point where it's safe for the environment and public health. And when we accomplish that, we feel it's a great accomplishment. But sort of even a greater accomplishment is when we can remediate a site to the point where it then can be transferred to a developer and then be developed into a useful property. And this is a case study that I'm going to present today that exactly happened at this site. And the way we did that was through developing a site-wide remedial strategy, applying multiple remedial techniques and approaches at a former pharmaceutical manufacturing facility in northern New Jersey. What you see in the aerial is the red line is the property outline of a plant. Nearly to the northeast, nearly to the northeast is a river that's immediately adjacent to the plant. And also bring your attention to the southwest across this road is actually an active university that is very thriving with college students and was very interested in this property once we talked about development. So those things will all come into the case study. So we put a timeline together for the project when we were presenting it to the agencies. It was a 60-acre pharmaceutical. They did R&D and pilot plant facilities with many buildings and square foot of operations. When we got involved in the project, there were extensive environmental investigations that had already been conducted over the last 30 years. And some of the key things, the investigations were initiated in 1984. And then another key execution of an administrative consent order with the state agency, New Jersey DEP, which required a groundwater extraction and treatment system to be installed to provide hydraulic control to prevent any migration to that adjacent river we saw in the previous slide. This also was a RCRA 2020 site, so EPA Region 2 was also involved and initially had drafted a RCRA corrective action permit. But as the project proceeded, they deferred to New Jersey DEP and were only monitoring and approving specific items. So this was technically a state lead site under RCRA, but we did have EPA oversight and conditions. So AECOM became involved in this project in May 2000. That's 21 years ago. So I've been involved at the site for quite a bit of time. And when we met with the responsible party, they were getting frustrated with the agencies because it seemed like they were focusing on the minutiae or specific areas of concern as opposed to the site-wide risks associated with the site. So we decided with the responsible party to put together what we called a comprehensive site conditions report that summarized all of the investigations and remedial actions that had been conducted previously at the site and try to focus the agencies on the site-wide risks so that we could proceed with some type of a remediation plan to bring the site towards closure. So as a result of the CSCR report, we identified specific what we called residual contamination areas that needed to be addressed. And these were those that were specifically essentially hotspots at the site that could be remediated and bring and make progress towards closure. So we did pilot testing associated with those RCAs. We got acceptance by the DEP and EPA going forward, which was critical, and then eventually moved into a full-scale remediation in the mid-2000s. And then as we get further in 2000s, obviously we start to run into vapor intrusion issues. And so based upon some vapor intrusion investigations, we identified an additional RCA that had to be added to the program. And then eventually in 2010, as this was all going on, the responsible party decided to close the plant. And as part of that, they were looking to possibly move the property and so that development could occur and that the site. So to do that, we had to move forward with the remediation program aggressively. This just gives you an overall view from the RCRA of corrective action, the solid waste management units, and areas of concern. And as you can see, most of the contaminated areas and where the chemical storage was occurring was in the northern part of the property. You'll see this orange snake-like is the actual groundwater extraction and treatment system that was installed to prevent migration of groundwater into the adjacent river. And this was a very low-yielding aquifer, so this had to be a system that used air-driven pumps spaced very closely together to be able to create the capture zone to prevent migration. And it was deemed to be effective. We did investigations of the river and sediments and confirmed that it was being effective at preventing migration, which was a critical factor to moving on. You'll see down here, this area shaded is a historic fill area that was just capped and denoted and really wasn't having impact on the environment. When we did the conceptual site model, we identified that we have about 35 feet of overburden with approximately 15 feet of saturated zone. And then we had weathered bedrock with a significant upward gradient. And this was actually an advantage to us. It prevented vertical migration. And when we did an evaluation of what was occurring at the groundwater extraction system, we actually saw that we were recovering some of the weathered bedrock aquifer as well as the overburden aquifer. And this upward gradient actually helped to reverse groundwater flow direction to prevent migration to the river as well as across the river to the other side of the property. So we got together with the client and decided, based upon the CSCR that we had developed, we tried to develop a site-wide remedial strategy, moving the site towards closure. We presented this actually in a meeting to DEP and EPA and got their acceptance, which was critical. We implemented it and then monitored it and updated the strategy as needed, not just assuming status quo. Because there was an administrative consent order in place, we had to maintain compliance, which specifically said that the groundwater extraction and treatment system had to be maintained and had to prevent migration. So that was a key critical that we maintained that. All right, then when we looked back into the plant, we saw that the key constituents of concern and typical ones that you'll see were the pharmaceutical plant. We had aromatics. We had significant alcohol concentrations in groundwater, including methanol. The chlorinated solvents were not a real driver at this site. They were minimal. But then again, we did see 1,4-dioxane as an emerging contaminant as we proceeded. And this was as a pharmaceutical product not associated with stabilizers with chlorinateds, which you will often see at different sites. But in the pharmaceutical business, they actually use 1,4-dioxane in the manufacturing process. So we developed remedial objectives and screened different technologies that could be used at these RCAs with our goal to reduce concentrations for eventual natural attenuation and shutdown of the groundwater extraction system. This is just a site figure showing the different RCAs that came out of the CSCR. You'll see we had six identified across the property, and we used fate and transport modeling to develop remedial action objectives for each of these RCAs, assuming that if they were migrating toward the river, those that are farther away from the river obviously could have more liberal remedial action objectives, and those that were closer to the river would need to have more significant remediation. And as you can see, one of the significant hotspots, of course, was just adjacent and upgrading of the river. So that was key focus. And these three RCAs were the key ones that were the main ones that we had to focus on. These we were able to quickly address through the program. So our client, before investing in all this, asked us to do a cost-benefit analysis. Sorry about that. Asked us to do a cost-benefit analysis so they could present it to the higher-ups in the company to demonstrate that it would be worthwhile to do this. So we did an evaluation and came up that if there was a cost savings of, if we could reduce the operating period by 15 years, it would provide a return on investment on the actual groundwater extraction operating system, which had been predicted for 40 years. So we did initial pilot testing to conduct of different technologies to confirm the feasibility and to develop costs and more defined costs. And as we were doing that, we got together with the client and realized that the ground extraction system had been operating for many years and it was beginning to end its useful life. There were many upgrades and replacements that would be necessary. So anything that could be done to remediate these areas to reduce the need of the ground extraction system became an even bonus and more cost effective. So we went out and conducted pilot testing of four of your conventional pneumatic remedial technologies, including soil vapor extraction, dual phase extraction, air sparging, and enhanced bioremediation through biosparging. Now, AECOM, we have our own fleet of pilot testing equipment, so we can just attach these units onto a pickup truck, take them out to the site, and using existing mining wells in many cases, we can run our pilot tests very cost effectively. The one on the left is our dual phase extraction unit that is a seal oil liquid ring pump that can create vacuums up to 30 inches of mercury. We have an air water separator that separates the vapors and the groundwater. And then an oil water separator that is there to remove any linapples if we do some kind of multi-phase extraction pilot test. And then we can direct those streams to treatment units, mobile treatment units as needed. The one on the right is our biosparge and air sparging compressor trailer that we use. In that case, we would have to install some sparge wells to be able to apply. But we could do that specifically for the pilot testing in specific areas to develop design parameters. So following the pilot testing, it was decided to use high vacuum dual phase extraction to address those areas with high mass, primarily toluene and benzene, including some linapple, which was addressed immediately. Actually, during the pilot study, we removed the linapple and it never returned. And then for those areas with alcohols and with lower concentrations, we decided to go with enhanced biosparging, primarily to attempt to remediate the some low levels of toluene, methanol, MTBE, and 1,4-dioxane. And as we proceeded, we came to realize that because of the toluene presence in the groundwater, we were actually co-metabolically aerobically biodegrading 1,4-dioxane, which has been demonstrated. So as the toluene levels drop, the 1,4-dioxane levels will go up, but as the toluene levels increase, we saw 1,4-dioxane decrease. So it was interesting that we had definite lines of evidence that we were treating 1,4-dioxane as long as the toluene is present. And then when you used enhanced biosparging in series with the diaphase extraction at a couple areas where we got the high mass removed and then moved into biosparging as a polishing technique as we move forward. And I have a picture here of one of our trailers we designed. And as you can see, with one liquid wing pump, we were able to apply 11 dual phase extraction wells to this manifold, which was quite a challenge to design, but it was effective at being able to apply vacuum and air to various dual phase extraction wells throughout a site and be able to do it with just one liquid ring pump, and it was very effective at sites where we used it for multiple dual phase extraction wells. So we actually constructed these trailers for the client and they purchased them and they were their ownership. And the one on the left is the dual phase extraction, which had the liquid ring pump, the air water separator, the oil water separator. And then we would just pull up two wells that we installed. We would use quick connect type connectors and mostly above ground. And we were able to effectively apply this at various RCAs using these mobile units. The one on the right is the biosparge trailer, which had a compressor in it that was able to apply to the biosparge wells, compressed air and flow. And as you'll see in the next picture, for vapor phase, we use vapor phase carbon units for the vapor treatment off the dual phase extraction system. And we use like quick connect couplers so that we could do this very easily and mobily change out the carbon units as needed. And then this is a picture on the right of the biosparge manifold with regulators and airflow meters so that we could apply air to multiple biosparge wells. And we also had the capability, if necessary, to add nutrients. If we saw nutrient depletion during the biosparging operation, we could add nutrients to the airstream in the gaseous phase if required. So when we were running dual phase extraction at a site, and this was not at this site, but it was used, this design was used at the site that we developed at another site, we were running a pilot test of a dual phase system. And with dual phase systems and multi-phase extraction systems, you use what we call a slope tube, and it's adjustable, the depth of that. So if you had product at the ground, at the soil groundwater interface, you could slope the product up and remove that. And then as the product was removed, if you wanted to then dewater the area through the high vacuum, you would then lower your slope tube to the point at the bottom of the well so that you could create a dewater zone and pull air through not only this well and then groundwater concurrently. That would be one way of recovering it. But when we were doing a pilot test at a site, I was out at the site and we weren't really getting really good recovery, the groundwater flow or airflow or mass recovery. So we had a shallow well nearby, so we just decided to manifold that into the system to see if we could possibly increase the flow with displacement of air, similar to what you would do with a gas can when you pull the vent up and you get much better flow. So we identified when we manifolded this in to the other well, the dual force extraction well that was primarily recovering groundwater, We then were pulling actually contaminated air and displacing the air, and we saw an order of magnitude increase in mass recovery and flow. So this was a design that we developed at another site and then used at the pharmaceutical plant when we installed dual phase extraction wells to optimize the system. So some dual phase extraction systems will tell you to bleed in clean air, but in this case, we were actually bleeding in contaminated air, which gave us an order of magnitude higher increase in VSA mass recovery. So this is kind of a custom design we developed and implemented at this site. So we developed a site-wide remedial strategy, which was to maintain the groundwater extraction system, implement the remediation program at the RCAs, to remediate objectives that we developed using modeling so that we would meet certain criteria. And then hopefully in the future, we would be able to shut down the groundwater extraction system and go with MNA, monitored natural attenuation, with a classification exception area, which is an institutional control in New Jersey that identifies the contaminated groundwater that's present so that no potable wells or any use of it is going. So that is an institutional control that can be used with MNA in New Jersey. And then in 2010, the client decided to cease operations and look to sell the property and close it out. So we aggressively remediated things, and this kicked us into the New Jersey DEP ISRA Industrial Site Recovery Act program, which with any facility that closes, ceases operations before it can be transferred or sold, needs to have a remediation program in place with at least financial assurance for the cost, estimated cost of remediation, so that there can be financial insurance to make sure when it's sold through a remediation agreement that it does get remediated. It also kicked in the Site Remediation Reform Act, which required an LSRP. But because this was a record 2020 site, not only did we need an LSRP, we also had New Jersey DEP oversight and EPA oversight. And our client, very proactively, when they wanted to sell the property, decided to do a due diligence assessment, and I've never seen this at any other site. And the primary reason they were doing their own due diligence assessment for purchasers was to demonstrate that the clean portions of the property, which if you remember, most of the operations were in the northern, that they really were clean. So they went out and did kind of a phase one, phase two assessment of the areas that were not part of the operations and identified with contamination to demonstrate to any purchasers that there were clean portions of the property that could be developed very quickly and used as needed. So it was a very proactive and effective means of making the property more marketable. Because we were trying to sell the property, we had to close two record hazardous waste storage facilities under EPA's oversight, as well as 9 spill USTs. We had to issue response action outcomes. We had to implement deed notices and engineering controls for any residual soil contamination. And we had to get New Jersey to issue remedial action permits for not only the soil, but also the groundwater, including the pump and treat system, so that this property would be amenable for sale. And then we continued to do this while we were doing this whole process, and we were essentially racing to the finish line to see if we could make this facility possible for sale. So as you know, real estate, location, location, location is everything. And when brownfield developers saw the university across the street that had a vested interest, as well as a nearby New Jersey transit train station, which made it very viable for commuters, they were very interested in it, and we started to look at different brownfield developers that might be interested. Our client also wanted to see if liability transfer was possible with the brownfield developer, so we were looking at fairly sophisticated developers. In that case, the developer would end up assuming our remedial strategy with the DEP and EPA. So we did find a brownfield developer who was interested. They proposed mixed-use development, and as you can imagine, we had multiple stakeholders and issues. We had the responsible party, EPA, New Jersey DEP, the developer, as well as the college who had a vested interest in it. So we had to work with multiple stakeholders in meetings to get through. Demolition was a key issue because the property had significant asbestos and lead-based paste issues, so it had to be worked out between the responsible party and the brownfield developer to share that cost. Financial assurance was the main issue with DEP and EPA. If liability was transferred, the new brownfield developer would have to maintain the financial assurance that was in place for remediation. And of course, with the aromatics and VOCs, vapor intrusion was an issue for any residential use because it was going to be used for mixed use. So this is an artist's rendering of the proposed development. You can see, because it's in a college area, we're looking at a Panera Bread, a Chipotle. In the back was actually residential condominiums that were going to be installed. And as you can see over in the back end of the property, the college's investment, they wanted a hall that could be used by their college students incorporated into the design and development. So that was one of their requirements. So this is a street view. You can see the Panera Bread was actually built and is being in use, as well as the Chipotle. There were other retail facilities as well as commercial operations in the plant. And we went up recently and took some pictures. This is that hall that you saw in the back, back 40 that was developed for use by the college. This is some of the residential properties that were there. This was actually used by the faculty for a residency for faculty that were visiting the college, which was another nice thing that was able, the developer was able to incorporate for the college. And one thing I forgot to mention, when a developer brought in his development, the groundwater treatment system had to be relocated. So the Barron Fields developer actually relocated the groundwater treatment system to the northwestern edge of the property and made it blend in nicely with the development. And it was to be a much more reduced system compared to what was used by the pharmaceutical, which had a large plant associated with their industrial wastewater. And this is now treating all of the manifolds and conveyance lines had to be rerun up to this location and now being discharged to the POTW for the development. So just to summarize and some of the lessons learned, one of the keys was doing a site-wide strategy development, putting that report together that summarized everything and presented it to the agencies in a way that could understand the risks was critical. By doing the RCA, the residual contamination remediation in concert with the extraction system, was definitely, when we had hydraulic control, we could then go forward. The mobile remediation trailers allowed us to move from one RCA to the est and made it more cost effective. And at one point we actually used, we did some pulse operations where we would go forward with in one area, and once we saw mass recovery was asymptotic, we would then move to another area. And so we could do some pulse operation by having mobile trailers. And the key is looking beyond the status quo. The client could have just gone with the groundwater extraction system, meeting the ACO, but they went forward proactively even before they thought they would close the plant. And by doing that, we're able to have a very effective implementation, which did result in the sale and redevelopment of the Brownfields property. So it's a true success story from start to finish. So that's it.
Excellent, David. Thanks so much for sharing your successful project with us. Hey, quick question. We have received several questions. We will hold a majority of them for the Q&A period. But David, there was a question regarding if you could let the audience know what the river or the adjoining college was.
No, I cannot do that.
Okay, very good. Understood. Thank you. We appreciate it, and thanks again for an excellent presentation. Well, let's move on to our second panelist. Our next speaker is Ms. Amy Calloway. Amy is a project manager for Black & Veatch in Atlanta. She's worked as a project manager and a project geologist for Black & Veatch for 15 years. Her work has involved site investigation and remediation at over 30 Superfund NPL sites, Department of Defense facilities, and state facilities. Amy's area of expertise is in CERCLA site remediation and advanced site characterization tools. She received a bachelor's degree in geology from Georgia Southern University and a master's in geology from Texas Christian University. Amy is a licensed professional geologist in Georgia, Tennessee, Mississippi, and Florida. Amy's presentation today is titled Using Adaptive Management to Overcome Data Gaps and Stakeholder Uncertainty During a Complex Remedial Design. Please welcome Amy.
Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you, Todd. My presentation today will be about the American Creosote Works Superfund site located in Pensacola, Florida. As you can see here in the historical aerial photograph, you can see the past operational structures. Located here are the main and overflow ponds. If you can blow up the screen, you can still see a little bit of creosote here in the overflow pond. These ponds were used for disposal of processed waste. Prior to 1970, wastewater in these ponds were allowed to overflow through a spillway through the streets and storm drains of the Sanders Beach community into a ditch on the Pensacola Yacht Club property, which led to Bayou Chico and eventually to the Pensacola Bay. The ACW facility treated wood products using creosote from 1902 to to 1981. Use PCP after 1950. Site contaminants of concern are PAHs, including naphthalene and PCP, dioxin, and large volumes of creosote and apple. There have been several rods signed for the site. OU2 groundwater rod for NAPL extraction was signed in 1994. That system ran intermittently for 12 years and was shut down in 2011 in order to, pending selection of a new remedy. In 2016, a site-wide rod was signed. Stakeholders for the ACW site include the Sanders Beach community, which is the surrounding residential community, Pensacola Yacht Club, City of Pensacola, Escambia County, FDEP, and the EPA. Due to the complexity of the ACW site, the approach used to evaluate potential remedy alternatives was to divide the site into contaminated media zones, or CMZs, which we define as areas that have common characteristics which affect the remedial alternative selection. This red area here is CMZ1, also known as the main source area, which encompasses the former waste ponds. The stratigraphy of the site includes a low permeability clay at about 110 feet below land surface, and the selected remedy for CMZ1 is a barrier wall with cap. Prior investigations indicate that NAPL exists under the former waste ponds at depths of 20 to 80 feet below land surface. During investigations, numerous borings were installed within the interior or along the alignment of the barrier wall to confirm the depth of the low permeability clay. The remedial design includes 1,700 linear foot barrier wall to a depth of 115 feet. Sorry, real quick. CMZ2 is the extended NAPL plume, and the remedy is for steam-enhanced extraction. CMZ2 is separated in two areas. The small sliver, brown sliver here, is CMZ2A, which is located completely on site, and the yellow zone here is 2B, which is located off facility. NAPL is known to exist here in the on-site area at a depth of 136 feet. The treatment depth for this area will be to 150 feet. The off-facility zone here, NAPL is known to exist to about 25 feet, and the treatment zone will be from to 30 feet. Precautions in this area were taken to disturb the area as little as possible due to the residential nature of the neighborhood. The design team utilized horizontal laterals, which will be required to collect contaminated vapors to prevent fugitive gas emissions from entering buildings such as the condominiums, which are located right here on the corner. The steam-enhanced extraction design includes over 350 wells, which include steam injections, multi-phase extraction, temperature monitoring points, and performance monitoring wells. Piping for the steam injection wells and multi-phase extraction wells will need to pass under the road, as seen here, for conveyance to the equipment compound, which will be located on site. CMZ3 is known as the secondary source zone and is located on facility, which contains NAPL-stained soils and leachable soil concentrations of SCOCs and PCP. Selected remedy is a combination of visco and enhanced bioremediation treatment barriers. Design includes the use of an upgradient seen as the blue line here on the northern boundary, and a combined ISCO and ISEB treatment barrier along the southern edge of the facility. The ISCO and ISEB barrier will provide immediate relief from contamination, effectively isolating the on-site secondary source from the downgradient plume and potential impacts to the Pensacola Bay. CMZ4 is a surface soil contamination. Similar to CMZ2, this is also separated into two zones. Zone A is located on-site, and Zone B is located off-site. Selected remedy is excavation and disposal on-site. Soil will be encapsulated into the barrier wall or for long-term isolation in an engineered containment cell. Docks and concentrations in this zone exceed the land disposal restrictions and are considered a principal threat waste. Zone A on-site includes excavation of all unsaturated contaminated superficial soil from 0 to 3 feet, and Zone B, located off-site, will be excavated from anywhere from 6 inches to a maximum depth of 3 feet. Soil samples were collected from each parcel to determine the excavation depth. You can see here that there will be two capped areas, and the level surface at the end of the action will be one level surface. Discussions with stakeholders throughout the project centered around height of the capped areas. The city requested that the design incorporate a single elevation surface to accommodate the site reuse plan. To accommodate the single elevation surface, it was determined that a portion of the excavated soil would need to go outside the barrier wall into the engineered containment cell to create a level surface across the height. The cap is estimated to be an average mound height of 13 feet above sea level. CMZ5 is the extended groundwater plume, and the selected remedy is a combo of ISCO and enhanced bioremediation treatment. This zone was written in the ROD as an interim design. As you can see here, the barrier wall is placed at the toe of the bay here. Groundwater monitoring will be conducted to assess the effectiveness. Groundwater monitoring will be conducted to assess the effectiveness of the DNAPL source treatment in reducing the SVOC plume on the west side of the site. This recommendation reflects the consideration that active treatment at the foot of the bay should not be necessary if contaminant reduction is achieved following implementation of source area remedies. Based on conversations with the EPA and the state, the preferred sequencing was to implement the residential soil excavation first to help maintain the outstanding relationship with the community. This remedial action is to be followed by treatment of the source areas, which include the steam-enhanced extraction and then the barrier wall. And the last remedy to be implemented, of course, will be the groundwater ISCO and ISCB biobarriers. During the design efforts of the soil contamination area outside of the barrier wall, it was noticed that this area overlapped with the proposed thermal treatment area. Due to this, the team had to revise the sequencing due to the sequencing of the remedy implementation. The design team developed and presented multiple iterations to the client to discuss the sequence of the remedy implementation. The design document was broken into three separate deliverables corresponding to the likely implementation phases and stakeholder priorities. Once a collaborative decision was made regarding scheduling, the three designs were completed. Shown here is a schematic of the site reuse. This was just one of the ideas. Throughout the FS and RD, it was known by the site team that the overall goal of the site was for reuse as a recreational park for the community. The team had multiple meetings with stakeholders to ask questions about the reuse requirements, such as what should the end elevation of the cap be, where there'll be lighting required on the cap, the utilities required, where would parking be required, any building foundations needed. City had polled the surrounding local residents for ideas for reuse. They even held a local community college that had multiple teams that did different designs. This is not the actual reuse, but just shows one of the team's designs, that which included an amphitheater and a park. It was just a very interesting project to be involved in to see all the ideas that were considered. Black and Beach has intentionally left the design as flexible as possible to allow for enhancements by the selected RA contractor. Stakeholder engagement activities, which were held throughout the project life, include assisting EPA with property access within the Sanders Beach community, meetings with EPA and FDP throughout the FS and remedy selection process, assisted EPA with proposed plan and record of decisions, and meetings with city officials to determine site reuse plans throughout the remedial design process. And that concludes my talk.
Well, good. Thank you, Amy. Wonderful. And let's move on to our final speaker for panel five today. Our final speaker is Dr. J.C. Kim. Dr. Kim is a senior project manager with Tetra Tech in their King of Prussia, Pennsylvania office. He has master's and PhD degrees in environmental engineering from the Illinois Institute of Technology and the University of Pittsburgh. His expertise includes landfill cover and leachate gas collection system design, anaerobic digester design, site remediation, and regulatory compliance support. Dr. Kim has worked on many Superfund sites, emphasizing consensus-based solutions at publicly sensitive sites. He has extensive experience with remedial investigations, feasibility studies, remedial design, water and wastewater treatment, and leachate and landfill gas management strategies for both public and private clients. Dr. Kim will present today on the design of evapotranspiration cover systems in humid climates. Please welcome Dr. Kim.
Thanks, Todd. Good afternoon, everyone. My name is J.C. Kim with Tetra Tech. Today, I'm presenting our remedial design work for one of operable units for the Lower Darby Creek area site and talk about how we collaborated with the stakeholders to make the design successful. Let me start with a site background. The Lower Darby Creek Area Superfund site is located in Philadelphia and Delaware counties in Pennsylvania. It is not too far from the Philadelphia International Airport. What you see at the bottom of the picture is a taxiway of the airport. The site was proposed to the NPL in 2000 and placed on the NPL in June 2001 with two landfills, Clearview Landfill and Folcroft Landfill and Annex. The site has been investigated under three operable units. Operable Unit 4 for site-wide aquatic environment was recently added. OU2 is being investigated by a group of potentially responsible parties under EPA's supervision, and other operable units are funded. RIFF activities on OU2 and OU3 are ongoing. The record of decision for OU1 that addresses Clearview landfill soil and waste was issued in 2014. The OU1 remedial design was completed in December 2018, and its remedial action started in March 2019. This presentation focuses on the work associated with OU1RD. I will also briefly touch on ongoing OU1RA work. Clearview landfill was privately owned and operated without a permit from 1950s to 1970s by the Clearview Land Development Corporation and used for disposal of municipal and industrial waste collected from the city of Philadelphia and portions of Delaware County. Former landfilling operations initially began in Delaware County land parcel, but also occurred on adjacent property located within Philadelphia County. When the landfill was closed in 1973, it occupied approximately 65 acres. The historical footprint includes the landfill itself, the Eastwick Recreational Park east of the landfill, and portion of the Eastwick neighborhood. As shown on this slide, the landfill is completely surrounded by FEMA's 100-year floodplain. Large portion of the Eastwick neighborhood is also within 100-year floodplain, therefore has high risk of inundation. One of major design challenges was to design the ET cover within 100-year floodplain. In general, this means we cannot fill within the floodplain, and we need to demonstrate that post-construction conditions do not raise water surface elevation within 100-year floodplain. In addition, the landfill is situated next to the creeks. Both Darby and Cobbs Creek are tidal. They fluctuate twice a day for 5 feet. As a result, the entire western bank of the landfill has been severely eroded and scoured. So we designed in-stream features to stabilize the creek bank and protect the integrity of the landfill. This is a snapshot of OU1 remedy. During RD, we designed remedial components, including 50-acre ET cover shown in gray, two large restoration wetlands, which are being used as a temporary sediment basins during construction, bioswale between the two wetlands to capture runoff from the landfill, stream restoration features such as log veins, creek walls, and mud fills along the creek bank, large block retaining wall along the creek side of the landfill. We needed this feature because the creek side landfill is very stiff, as the grading contours show. We try to avoid major cut to minimize exposure risk to workers during construction and prevent filling within the floodplain. Next remedial component is the relocation of on-site businesses and demolition of structures that are located within the ET cover boundary. We also designed collection trench and pump stations to capture leachate shifts along the creek bank. Lastly, we designed on-site constructed wetlands for leachate treatment. EPA deferred the construction of last two remedial components due to uncertainty of effectiveness of treatment wetlands on emerging contaminants of concern, such as PFAS and 1,4 dioxane. EPA will address this medium as a part of OU3 groundwater remedy. Before I proceed, I want to acknowledge several stakeholders that provided technical support and consultations for the project. Without their support, we could not complete the design successfully. First and foremost, I want to thank EPA BTEC. BTEC was instrumental in ET cover design and implementation. Specifically, BTEC helped selection of tree species suitable for ET cover, planting timing, and establishment and extension of research nurseries. Army Corps of Engineers helped relocation of on-site businesses and access agreement and easement for parcels. U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service provided technical support and design consultation for in-stream stabilization features. Pennsylvania Game Commission allowed us to use a land for research nurseries. Lastly, EPA Office of Solid Waste and Emergency Response Team supported pre-design investigation using incremental sampling methodology, statistical data analysis, and fingerprint analysis for determination of background contamination. There were more parties supporting the project than listed here. I appreciate all their support for the project. Community involvement is an important element in EPA's cleanup processes. During the RD, Tetra Tech supported EPA to develop the community involvement plan to inform, engage, and promote two-way communication between the community and the agency. This plan is a living document, so will evolve and be modified as the cleanup processes continue and as input is received from the community. With a similar context, we also developed the community health and safety plan to inform the community the work to be done as a part of the cleanup, potential risks and safety procedures that will be put in place before and during construction, as well as contact information. The community advisory group was formed in 2015. EPA also awarded technical assistance grant for the community. Currently, there are 15 resident members, 6 expert resources, and representatives from EPA and PADEP. They usually meet on second Wednesday of every month. The CAG members inform other residents about the progress of the project and other information gathered from the meeting. The TAC group was formed to support the CAG for understanding of engineering design. Lastly, Tetra Tech supported EPA to maintain a community notification system. This system currently accommodates up to 1,000 people and provides emergency notification or project-related updates by email, voice call, and text messages. There were several design criteria for ET cover. First, we should demonstrate equivalent standard of performance. That is, annual average permeability of ET cover should be less than 10 to the minus 5 centimeter per second, which is RCRA, subtitle D, final cover requirement. We graded the landfill surface to maintain its slope less than 33% for stability, while minimizing significant cuts to protect workers from exposure risk during construction. We also designed ET cover with other features to avoid filling within the 100-year floodplain. The principle of ET cover is water balance. Unlike conventional landfill cover with an impermeable layer, ET cover relies on soil properties to store water until it is either transpired by vegetation or evaporated from soil surface. This concept is illustrated on the left. Compared to conventional cover systems, ET cover is expected to be less costly and, more importantly, more sustainable, as demonstrated by environmental footprint analysis performed during the RD. It's moving. To determine specific requirements for ET cover, we ran the water balance model with various combinations of input parameters, such as soil types, soil thickness, and vegetation types with a given amount of precipitation. We iterated these input parameters until the model output satisfied the goal of permeability being less than 10 to the minus 5 centimeters per second. Based on this modeling result, we predicted ET cover with such a combination of 2 feet CLT loam and 700 hybrid poplar trees, for example, would meet this equivalent standard of performance over time. So how do we know if ET cover performs and functions as designed? There are several ways. First, percent aerial coverage by planted tree species will be used to evaluate performance of vegetation on ET cover. And random plots are also selected and examined on the ground for verification. The second method is the use of leaf area index. Leaf area index is defined as the ratio of the leaf area of active vegetation to the land surface area. The water balance model estimated permeability of ET cover with various vegetation conditions that are represented by respective leaf area index values. Field measurement of leaf area index can confirm accuracy of leaf area index values used by the model. The third method is a direct measurement of soil moisture content within ET cover. Together with weather stations, soil moisture probes will be used to assess ET cover water storage change over time and to determine when the water storage capacity of the ET cover has been exceeded. Lastly, field survey will be conducted to check the survival rate of desired plant community. Again, the entire landfill is within 100-year floodplain, so we developed the hydraulic model focusing on the site and surrounding flood-prone areas with both existing and proposed RD conditions. The model compared the water surface elevations under the two conditions to determine whether the design has adverse impacts on the floodplain. We ran the model incrementally when we completed preliminary, intermediate, pre-final, and final RLD. What you see on the right is a screenshot of the Hackross model for 90% RLD conditions, indicating slightly increased water surface elevations around the southern landfill and Eastwick neighborhood for 100-year and 500-year storm events. After further grading, we eventually got rid of all orange lines at 100% RD conditions. As a note, although not required, we looked at 500-year storm events as a part of modeling to see potential impact due to sea level rise per the guidelines for Executive Order 11988 and 13690. As I explained earlier, ET cover requires specific vegetation to maximize evaporation and transpiration. The design estimated approximately 46,000 trees and shrubs will be required to ensure that the ET cover will function as designed and to maintain long-term viability. Therefore, two research nurseries were established during the RD. We initially established a small one on Clearview landfill. Then we later established a larger one on state game land in New Tripoli using cuttings from the landfill nursery. EPA BTAC and U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service helps selection of tree species, planting, and harvesting from the nurseries. The upper photo shows planting activity in New Tripoli using live stakes from the landfill nursery. The lower photo shows 1.5 years later. These trees are being planted on ET cover now. As I mentioned before, stream banks along the western side of the landfill were severely scoured and had exposed waste at locations. A photo in this slide shows existing conditions of creek banks. It is EPA's policy to use greener and sustainable cleanup, so we try not to use hardscaping structures. A concept plan within the project area was initially developed by U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. In general, this concept plan does not propose changes to the overall stream pattern or vertical profile. Instead, focus is placed on utilizing in-stream structures to stabilize the banks and reduce erosive stresses in critical areas. With that in mind, we designed three types of in-stream structures, including mud sill, log veins, wood creep walls. Actual construction of these features will be presented in the following slides. You will see how the creek bank looks like now after construction. I'll show you a few slides for ongoing OU1 remedy construction. This is the ET cover constructed in phase one. As you see, there are lots of trees, although they look like sticks now. But I guess you have an idea from nursery photos that I showed you earlier. Most of the trees are cuttings from two research nurseries. 2-inch caliper trees and their roots were also procured and planted to mimic existing conditions. Each tree is protected with a plastic tube from damage by animals. We learned this from research nurseries. EPA started residential yard removal action in 2017 and continued under OU1 RA. Basically, top 2 feet of surface contaminated soil are excavated and backfilled with a clean fill. Excavated soils are consolidated under ET cover. To date, EPA remediated 157 homes and 2 open spaces in the neighborhood. What you see here is 2 in-stream restoration features constructed along the creek bank, mud sill and low creek wall. I showed you existing conditions earlier, so I think you see the difference. Mud sill was constructed using untreated hemlock logs. We set the elevation of base log at mid-tide elevation so that it can be effective in both high and low tides. Each lift was constructed with a topsoil, 2RC mix, wrapped around with a coal mat, which is made of coconut shell. Each lift was seeded and will be planted with live stakes that will grow well in wet environment. Mud fill provides bank stability and creates a stable undercut effect for aquatic habitat as well. A photo on the right is a log creep wall. We used it to stabilize steep banks with exposed waste. Hollow log cells were installed first and filled with the topsoil towards the mix. It will be also planted after completion. We anticipated to complete remedy construction by end of 2023. Thank you very much. Again, I'm JC Kim with Tetra Tech. I'm project manager for the project that I presented today. Josh Barber is EPA Region 3 RPM for the Lower Darby Creek Area site, and responsible for overall construction. Now I'm open for questions.
Thanks, JC. Fantastic presentation and a fascinating site. Hey, we've got several questions that have come in from the audience, and really appreciate folks reaching out with your questions. We will address those. JC, I had a quick question for you regarding the vegetated cap with the trees in a brackish flood scenario. You know, I'm just curious. We have here near my home in Denver, there are several golf courses that serve as essentially flood protection areas that get inundated and protect communities. And I've noticed that in when they serve their function well, which they have, there's severe damage to the courses after they're done, to the vegetation, both from the flooding itself, being inundated with water for 2 weeks, as well as significant sediment deposition on top of the vegetation following the flooding. I'm just curious, as part of your design, was there some contingency planning or other thoughts as to if a flood were to occur, given that it's brackish water, you know, what kind of O&M or other needs might occur if there's damage to the cover? Would it, if in a flood event, would the vegetation die?
Fortunately, in our case, majority of the ET cover is located above 100-year floodplain. So there will be minimal damage in the event of flooding for the site. However, we developed the O&M plan indicating how we need to maintain the ET cover, for example, through more vegetation and fixing soil cover thickness and all that. Still, I believe the maintenance requirement for ET cover is significantly less than conventional ET landfill cover with a geomembrane type layer, for example. Hope I answered your question.
You did. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. An excellent presentation as well. We've got some questions here for David. David, one of the questions that came in for your site was the thickness of the elm apple at the RCAs, and what was the cleanup goals regarding the elm apple? Was it complete removal? Was there a maximum thickness? Could you talk some more about the elm apple issues at your site?
Yeah, we had less than a foot of an apple and maybe two or three wells. And what was amazing, and touch wood, we did a pilot study to evaluate the sloping system with the multi-phase extraction. And during a pilot study, we essentially removed all the product during initial operation and never saw it come back. So that was not a big issue at the site. We were able to effectively remediate the linapple with the multi-phase extraction system and then move into addressing the solvents. We're very fortunate.
Excellent. There was another question regarding vapor intrusion. The audience had noticed the redevelopment of the residential areas, and there were some questions regarding what types of vapor intrusion mitigation, if any, needed to be done regarding the buildings that were constructed. Were there vapor barriers or depressurization systems? Could you speak to that a little bit?
As you noticed, they decided to put the residential in more of the contaminated areas, which wasn't our approach we would have taken, but they did incorporate a vapor barrier as well as a passive system for recovery that could be pulled into an active system if necessary. So that was definitely incorporated because of the residential use.
Okay, great. JC, a question for you regarding your project. Is the project located near the John Hines Wildlife Refuge?
Correct.
Very good. It appears some of our audience members know the site area well. Open question to any of the panelists. We have a question from the audience that is, what was the most difficult coordination issue with stakeholders regarding your case study? And what was a key lesson learned that you learned regarding stakeholder communication? Were any of the three case study sites located in environmental justice areas.
I can answer that question. What was critical to our and the lessons learned was when you're dealing with a responsible party, a brownfields developer, his LSRP, I was the LSRP for the responsible party, we had the two agencies, we all had to cooperate in a very good way if it was ever going to work out. We couldn't get into arguments over remediation techniques. We had to be able to share. And actually, the brownfields developer came in and did his own due diligence that we had to be open with him and communicate. So the key was communication, being able to work together for a common goal, which happened on this project, but I've seen where it doesn't happen on other projects. So that was the key to ours in making sure that we focused on good communication and cooperation.
Sure. Amy, how about you?
I would say that it was just getting a answer on final design of the site reuse while we were actively working on the remedial design. I mean, we didn't want to ever stop work on our end, so it was just making sure that everyone knew what our timeline was and when we needed answers by, so that we could all stay on target. And the site was not located in an environmental justice area, no.
And JC, it seemed like you had a lot of stakeholder cooperation from the various agencies. Was there any community faction that was opposed to your work at the site?
As I explained earlier, the community involvement activity has been extensively conducted, led by EPA, the RPM. So the site is located right next to the residential neighborhood. So the EPA thought that the best the way to proceed this cleanup activity would be informed the community early on of the process. So there were a lot of residential members participating in the cleanup process in the beginning. They were well informed what EPA plans to do and so on. So I think that's one of the key highlights of the project, so that we can avoid any challenging issues later on.
Very good, thank you. Amy, we've got a question regarding your presentation. Was the ISEB barrier for the bay protection new or intended to optimize to supplement an existing barrier or permeable reactive barrier already in place?
So the ISEB barrier that is proposed for on-site is the written into the rod. The one at the bay edge is an interim remedy to be implemented only if the source remedies are not successful in reaching the remedial goals. So I think it's important to also note that none of my remedial actions have been implemented. It is just that remedial design stage at this point in time.
Sure. When are you scheduled to do construction?
That will be up to when EPA puts it under the
time. So it could be several years before construction is implemented at your site.
Correct.
Sure. JC, we've got a comment or a question regarding the trees at your site. Poplar trees are fast-growing but very short-lived. What can you say about maintenance or replacement of the trees? And is this applicable in areas where the trees are dormant for part of the year?
Well, yes. We plant hybrid poplar trees, a lot of them, because they uptake water a lot. So that's good for ET cover. As I mentioned earlier, the goal of the remedy is demonstrating the annual average of permeability of EP cover equivalent to RCRA subtitle D landfill cover. So yes, dormant season trees may not uptake the water as much as, you know, the wet the growing season. However, again, on average, annually, if we can accomplish the goal of the permeability, then we are good to go. So again, we do need some maintenance of the ET cover, replanting trees and all that. So that's why we established the two research nurseries. So we have the trees ready on our hand, so we can cut them and plant on the ET cover when we need it. Hope I answered your question.
Yeah, very good. There's there's another question for you on a similar type of question regarding the trees. The question is, my understanding from your presentation is that trees will be planted on top of the closed landfill. If this is correct, what is being done to prevent the tree roots from penetrating the landfill and compromising the landfill cap?
I think the questioner a little bit confused with a conventional land, cover system. We don't have the barrier layer within EP cover. It's basically a soil cover with a good vegetation on top. So as you know, the hybrid popular, for example, their root system goes pretty deep. So it will penetrating to the landfill, you know, reach down to the waste underneath it, which is fine. So our purpose is that they develop the healthy root system as fast as possible and uptake the water as much as it could so that the precipitation does not reach down to the waste below the ET cover. So it is okay that the tree root penetrating the landfill cover.
Okay, very good. Thank you. Amy, we have a question for you. At your site regarding creosote, there's a question regarding odor control associated with any work at the site. Could you talk a little bit about how odor issues were evaluated regarding creosote and handled, and how were action levels arrived at and achieved regarding odor control threshold?
Sure. So the thermal design does include a vapor barrier to control odors, and I would not be able to answer the question if we set action levels. My memory is not remembering any action levels for odor thresholds. We'd have to go back to the remedial design for that. But again, it hasn't been implemented, so I can't tell you if we achieved them because
Sure. No, I appreciate it. So in general, the answer is regarding the thermal, you're going to capture any odors associated with that treatment through the vapor extraction system and the cover that will be placed down at ground level.
Absolutely correct.
Got it. Question for David. You mentioned enhanced biosparging for 1,4-dioxane. Can you elaborate on the treatment and how low concentrations of 1,4-dioxane you were able to achieve through the treatment options or through this treatment approach?
Sure. We had concentrations of 1,4-dioxane in the hundreds of parts per billion. And what has been proven through different in situ bioremediation investigations is that 1,4-dioxane will co-metabolically biodegrade in an aerobic environment, which we were creating primarily for aromatics, such as toluene and other compounds. But as an added input we got, we also, because of the toluene, saw co-metabolic degradation of 1,4-D, and it actually decreased to single digits in that area as long as the toluene was there. So it was a long process. And it wasn't really, 1,4-dioxane wasn't a real driver for the site because it was being recovered by the groundwater extraction system, but this was kind of an added input we got from trying to treat the others. We also were able to reduce the 1,4-D in the RCA areas. So that was pretty interesting.
So David, if I heard you right, you got down to single digits part per billion for 1,4-dioxane with the treatment. Is that correct?
At least an order of magnitude into the less than 10 is what we were seeing. It did fluctuate depending on toluene that was present, but by the end of the remediation process, we were in, and in New Jersey, the standard is 0.4, so we still weren't there, but we reduced it significantly through the metabolic process.
Very good follow-on question on the 1,4-dioxane. You didn't mention that there were any chlorinated solvents present at the site. Could you talk a little bit about the site history and how or why was 1,4-dioxane present?
Yes, we did have some chlorinated solvents, but they weren't drivers. They were just minor low concentrations, so let me clear that up. But what you typically see with 1,4-dioxane is it's primarily been used as a stabilizer with TCA, that kind of chlorinated solvent. But what also has been documented, and you'll see it in the RTRC fact sheets, that in the pharmaceutical process, they actually used 1,4-dioxane, the actual compound itself, not just as a stabilizer, in the manufacturing process. And so we did see that here and confirmed that it was not associated as a stabilizer, but was being used as part of the actual manufacturing process.
Ah, very good. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. It's unusual to see that.
You're right. Usually, you know, everybody sees it more or less, as you said, as a stabilizer at their chlorinated solvent site, but I'm not surprised to hear that the pharmaceutical industry uses it for other needs. So, GC, question regarding the mud sills and the design. General question was, are they resistant to erosion during storms, and can you talk a little bit about how they're specifically anchored?
Good question. Frankly, we learned a lot of techniques from U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service regarding this mud sill construction. So basically, to install mud sill, you install the trench box first and install the fill log, the long log first, perpendicular to the quick. We call it fill log. The fill log is about 12 to 18 inch in diameter and 8 to 12 feet in length. So we install this log, two-thirds of the log, into the bank within the trench and then backfill it. And then once it's that is the foundation of the mud sill. On top of that, we added the soil lift wrapped around with a core mat, you know, multiple lifts on top of it. So the sill log is also anchored with a 5 feet long rebar. So you know, it can be withstanding the any flooding event and washed off. That's what we did.
Yeah, very good. There's a follow-on question regarding some of the floodplain bank protection as well. Was there any net fill in the floodplain from the bank features? And if so, did you need a compensating cut or rely on HECRAS to demonstrate that some fill would be okay?
That's a very good question. As I mentioned earlier, the entire landfill is surrounded by 100-year floodplain. The creek adjacent to the landfill is a floodway, meaning 0% increase in water surface elevation is allowed. So what we did during the RD is that, so we already conceptually designed the size of each in-stream restoration features along the creek bank. So we incorporate that into Hackrath model. See if we violate or increase water surface elevation within the creek. So luckily, we were able to show the net zero increase. But once construction is completed, we may need to rerun the hydraulic model to demonstrate as-built condition surely meet FEMA's requirement, net zero water surface elevation within the creek.
Excellent. Well, thank you, JC, and thank you to all of the audience for some excellent questions during our Q&A period. We really appreciate the engagement. It adds value for everyone, for the panel. And thank you very much, David, Amy, and JC, for your excellent presentations today for Panel 5. Excellent work, and thank you for your time and sharing the successes and challenges for your projects regarding stakeholder coordination. We greatly appreciate it. Gene, with that, I believe we are
up on the screen. So you all now manually should be able to see our upcoming panel. And there's also some new slides up on the screen, and hopefully you all can see some interactive poll questions that are on there. And so I'm going to move a few things around and change things. And so as you all are getting sort of grouped and gathered together for our last symposium, I did want to introduce our speaker and sort of main facilitator, Dr. Mark Gershon, who's the chairman at the Department of Operations Management at Temple University. He earned his BS in Industrial Engineering from the University of Pittsburgh, his Master's in Aerospace and Mechanical Engineering from the University of Arizona, and his PhD in Systems Engineering, also from Arizona. He is a registered professional engineer, a Lean Six Sigma Master Black Belt, and a certified project management professional. He began his career with the U.S. Army Project Management Office as a quality and reliability engineer, where he designed and implemented quality design and analysis programs for weapons systems. And I can tell you, after sitting in on the dry run, this group made me definitely very excited to learn more about project management. So with that, Mark, I'll go ahead and ask you to come off of mute and get started with our last session today.
Okay, great. Thank you very much, Jean. I'm glad we have such a big group, and I'm very excited about it because I spend most of my time with companies and government groups and so forth talking to project managers, hoping to make them better project managers. This is different. This is unusual. This is a talk aimed at people who are not yet project managers, hoping to get into it. So I'm just going to talk about project management and what it is and why we should get into it. Before we do that, though, I'd like to introduce our panel. We'll let them introduce themselves. Dan, do you want to get started?
Sure. I'm Dan Amati from GZA Geoenvironmental. I'm a licensed engineer as well. I have been with GZA now for 15 years, started as an entry-level engineer and worked my way up to senior project manager. And I specialize in the design and construction management of large-scale remediation projects running from, you know, $10 to $50 million. I'm also a project manager trainer within GZA. So I'll pass it now in alphabetical order over to Gordon.
Hi, I'm Gordon Arujo. I'm with UGI Utilities. We're a public utility that supplies natural gas to the majority of eastern and central Pennsylvania. My role at UGI is to manage our manufactured gas plant program, of which I've got 69 sites within Pennsylvania, and some sites are out of state as well that I manage. I started out in consulting myself at Tetra Tech, and I've now moved through various roles to become a project manager in charge of the 7GP program. And with that, I will pass over to Monica.
Hello, I'm Monica Fulkerson. I am a senior technical consultant, design manager, and project manager for Jacobs Environmental Solutions Market in the Charlotte, North Carolina office. I have more than 16 years of experience with federal and private clients, specializing in site management and remediation projects. I am specifically focused on the implementation of innovative remediation technologies, and I lead Jacobs Environmental Design Management Program. Now I will pass to Duncan.
Thank you, Monica. Good afternoon, everybody. Happy to be here today. My name is Dustin Capson. Work for a firm called AKRF, and I actually wish my name might have been JT Realmuto today, batting fourth here in the stepping up in project management panel, and honored to be doing so. But anyway, I'm an environmental consultant and primarily a project manager at AKRF, and I just recently obtained my New Jersey Licensed Site Remediation Professional certification. Work on several projects in New Jersey, New York, and Pennsylvania. And Mark, to kick it back to you, I've learned a lot from you about being a project manager just in preparation with this panel. You've led by example. So again, really happy to be here today and excited to hear some feedback from the crowd.
Okay, thank you very much, Dustin. I was actually beginning to think of Gene as our project manager here, but okay. You see the slide I have up is the first project manager, but before we get to that, I'm just looking at some of the poll results here, and it looks like our average age here is not limited to young professionals, but a good percentage of our people are in that category, so that's great. Everybody else, I'm hoping you can learn something about project management too. And may also still be looking to get into the field. In terms of years in the profession, we see that generally it's pretty much the same spread as the age groups. Many earlier in their careers, a little more intermediate in their careers. Okay. All right. It's just a quote here, first project manager, and it says, first, have a definite, clear, practical ideal, a goal, an objective. And you're going to see that can be part of our definition of a project in the first place. Second, have the necessary means to achieve your end. And that's what we have to do. We have to put the resources together. Aristotle says wisdom, money, materials, and methods. And then finally, put all those means to use. Adjust the means to your goal. And that's a long time ago, but I don't think much has changed. That's what we do as project managers. I wrote first project manager here, Aristotle, all the way back to the Greeks. But if you look in the Bible, there's a lot of discussion of some key projects, especially in the book of Nehemiah, a whole discussion, it's almost a project plan, for building the temple in Jerusalem. So project managers have been around whenever anything needed to be done. I've never found anything written on it, but you gotta think the guys who built the pyramids in Egypt were amazing project managers. So the outline of our discussion today is, first, four topics that are essential to the topic that we're discussing. Why would I be interested in this at all? What kind of preparation educationally and practically would we need? And initial a discussion about credentialing. At the end, I go into tools of project management a little bit. And of course, we're not teaching any tools today. I just want to mention them and what they are. But you'll see the three major tools essential to project managers. And then there's other tools that we use as well within the project. Okay, so let's go to why should I be a project manager. And before getting into that, we have some more poll questions. Were you aiming to get into project management when you started 100%, when you started working, and are you now aiming towards project management? And what I see here is what I really hoped to see. I was hoping for a certain percentage to say yes at the start. I'm a little surprised how high that is. And a much bigger percentage to be interested in project management after starting your career and learning what all this is about. And that's what's happened here. In fact, it's not doubled, but it's almost doubled, the percentage. And then what changed that moved you in this direction? That's going to be lots of different answers, but I like some of them I'm seeing. Field work, experience, seems like an important skill. An important skill is different than saying I want to go into that as a career. But we see that lots of things are happening after we start work that influence us, and the general direction is that it influences us toward the direction of project management. So why do I think we should go into project management? Well, first of all, what's a project? And how does it differ from other types of work? I want to say a project is something special. I want to start with that. And here's the definition of a project out of the book called the PMBOK. That's the basis for certification in project management. Temporary endeavor. If you thought by special I meant exciting, I think so, you might not, I don't know. But what I really meant is it's special outside of the usual. It's something we start, we finish, it's temporary. Temporary endeavor undertaken to create a unique, it's a one-time thing. When you finish the project, you don't go back and do it again. Why not? Because there was a goal, as Aristotle said, the product, service, the result that we're aiming for. So when you achieve that result, you're done. So it's a one-time effort. When you finish a project, I guess you could say you've worked yourself out of a job, but hopefully there's more projects coming up. So what makes something different about projects? Most work is repetitive. It's not one time. Most jobs are not projects. You are working in an industry, though, where most work is projects. And that's unusual. Usually most work is regular, routine, repetitive work, and there's some projects going on. You're in a project-based industry. So if I have reasons for getting into project management, you're in a project-based industry. I have that third here. So if you want to succeed in your industry, you want to know your industry, the way to do that is to get into project management. Number two I have here, it's the avenue for professional advancement. You go from working on a project to being heads of the project, and then from there maybe to higher positions in the company. But most important, because I don't want to say like number two implies here that it's just a stepping stone for you, is that projects are exciting. When I hear that most work is not projects and most work is repetitive, the word I would throw in there, I know this is my bias, but I would throw the word boring in there. Projects are not always something new, not always something nice, not very often stressful, but certainly exciting. And it will keep your career exciting, which you want. So what characteristics should we have in a project manager? I have some listed here. You have to be very detail-oriented. You have to be a good communicator. You have to be certainly committed to goals and passionate about them. And you have to be driven. You have to be tenacious in moving towards those goals. So the first question I posted here is, what's most important to becoming a project manager? And far and away, your responses are communication skills. When I see polls and when I see papers written and surveys of why projects fail, number one on the list is always communication. So you're dead right on that. When I have tools of project management that I want to talk about, this shows my tools aren't that important. Communication is what's important. What are other characteristics needed in a project manager? Certainly organized, patience, yes. Able to manage time and people and vendors, yeah, able to coordinate is the key word. So lots of good responses here. There's a textbook on project management that lists characteristics of a project manager. And when you see the list, you see that certain characteristics that you have to have and other characteristics that you have to have kind of don't go with the same type of person. Anybody who has one is not going to have the other. When you read that list, and your list too that you keep adding to here in front of me, none of us can have that. It's impossible. And this textbook that I'm bringing up has listed as the last characteristic required to be a project manager is must be able to walk on water. That one sums it up. We're going to do our best. We're going to struggle through it. We're going to try to have as many of these characteristics as we can. But none of us are going to be perfect for that. Okay, so that brings us to some comments I'd like from the panel. We can kind of go through in the same order every time rather than mixing it up. Dan, how has become a project manager added to your career?
Well, let's start off with it. First thing is it makes it more complicated. There's so many more responsibilities that I think a lot of people don't realize a project manager has. It's financial skills. It's communication skills. It's skills of just it's managing people, the people that you're working with. And it also makes your career as you're building up and learning skills. It's kind of it's satisfaction. It's not only being part of a team, but getting a job done, but it's becoming part of a team and watching your whole team succeed. So that's really a great part of it is you're no longer the person that's responsible for doing one thing and doing it maybe over and over again, but now you're watching other people within your group and within your team that you've assembled achieve a common goal and put together a good project and make that project happen. And that's really satisfying and rewarding.
And I like that word satisfying because that's a good feeling you get from this. Okay, Gordon?
Yeah, I think, as becoming a project manager, I guess the first time that I actually, I've never really had that title in my job title. My job title has never been project manager level one or something like that. It's always been environmental engineer level two or, something along those lines. And, in the role of project manager, you do have your technical qualities too that, that's your toolbox. That's how you know how to look at data. You know how to communicate with others. But the project management part is how do you, get everyone to work in harmony with each other. In my current role, I've got 8 different consultants that I work with on my MGP site program. My strategy for all of them is that they all talk to each other and that they're all friendly with each other and that they all share ideas with each other on sites that may or may not be the site that they're working on. Now, that sounds really crazy if you're a consultant and you have an end user, or an owner, that wants you talking to other consultants and brainstorming, collaborating. And for me, it's really exciting because I get to see innovation coming out of all these conversations. You know, if you put yourself in a room with really smart people that are smarter than you, most likely, and you get them talking, you're going to come up with some really powerful solutions to problems. And sometimes it's also, how do you handle with regulatory affairs? How do you manage talking to the regulator about a project? And it's really interesting to see when everyone actually comes to the table and, you know, advocates for everything that they know on your behalf as the project owner.
Great. Thank you so much, Gordon. That was good. That, between the two of you, you hit a lot. Monica, do you have anything to add to that?
I do. You know, certainly being a project manager has added depth to my career. You know, growing from being a doer to a manager allowed me to touch a lot more cool projects. Through team management and delegation, I had time to be involved in multiple projects at a time, and that helped me to grow my experience with different technologies, which is sort of where my passion lies. So now I serve in both technical and management roles, and becoming a proficient project manager helped me to build the acumen needed to be successful and to understand how to drive schedule and budget and contribute to the business. I noticed a moment ago someone wrote into the poll question that technical folks sometimes make the worst project managers, and I agree. And to flip that on its side, I strongly believe that there's power in being both technically proficient and skilled in project management, which translates to significant value to our projects and our clients.
Yeah, definitely. The project manager, if they don't understand the technical side, is in a weakened position. So that's a very important characteristic. We just have to rise above that and realize that that's not our job anymore. Okay, maybe I should reverse the order every time we go through this because Dustin, I'm sure they said everything. You're sitting there thinking they're taking away everything I wanted to say.
I mean, Mark, I was going to say that you're gonna make it really tough for me during this whole session. I mean, geez,
yeah, we'll make you first next time.
I'm only kidding. Those are great responses. You know, to me, when I first started my career, I actually always felt that it was a pretty unappealing description to be a project manager, so to speak. You know, it's not doctor, it's not lawyer, it's you know, it's not movie star, obviously. And even though, you know, some of us probably feel like we're on the show CSI from time to time, you know, when I first started out, I couldn't really see or feel the career path. Right, but then I knew I wanted to be successful. I knew I liked to see things get done. You referenced sort of the project, the temporary nature of that, which is really is beneficial to sort of get things done. But really, to do well, you have to be led by those that have been successful or leaders. And I've always taken leadership really, really seriously. And I feel that I've come to realize that really to lead, you have to master that art of management first. And you know, becoming a project manager and refining your practice there only improves your ability to lead. So that's what's added most to my career thus far.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. So we have four people who are still in the category of young professionals on our panel, but all who were experienced enough to have moved into project management. And you can see how much they enjoy it and are learning from it and growing and excited by it. So yeah, thank you very much. That's terrific. The second topic here is educational preparation. And I have here a slide which just says, why is this page, it says basically empty, but it's empty. My feeling is you didn't have any project management preparation in school. It was more of the technical thing. So we have some poll questions here. And I'm just asking, how many of you had project management taught as a subject in school? And in terms of that question, you can see it's overwhelmingly no in our group. And I had already discussed this with our panel, and they were no on this too. Does your employer have a formal project management training program, though, to promote advancement, to help you get into this field? There, we see about 50-50. It's actually 50% yes, 40% no, and 10% you don't know. And I'm assuming if you don't know, they don't have it. So from our panel, what kinds of training did you have? Was the topic ever brought up, even if there wasn't a class in it? Dustin, do you want to start this time?
Sure, Mark. I could be pretty short and sweet on this one, I think. Really, my answer is no. I really had none at all. And if it was sort of implied or suggested that we would be working in groups in class or doing things as teams, I really wish someone would have said from the start, hey, this is about project management, or this is about, really the crux of this is obviously what you teach is germane to the issue here. But I don't think that I ever benefited from classical training, call it, although I wish I would have. Mark, I believe you might be muted.
Yes, I am. Thank you. The closest you get in school is team assignments, team efforts that you have to do during a class. But it's really not discussed as projects, and if they call it a project, it's just a word they use. Okay, Monica?
I think that was good insight, Dustin. As many team projects as we do, it never occurred to me that that was a lesson in project management. My answer was going to be, no, not really training from school. I think the closest thing was taking an introductory construction management course. And I remember talking about scheduling and looking at Gantt charts and that being the only real time in school that I had learned about a critical path and, how to deliver on a bigger project. But beyond that, I would say no.
Okay, but that's certainly the basics of project management right there. So within another class. Great. Okay, Gordon?
Yeah, through college, I can't say that I ever had any formal project management training. I mean, I definitely had plenty of projects that, whether it was chemistry or chemical engineering or, wherever it might have been, they were often projects that as a team we had to, do some kind of task and then report on that task. So there's the, the planning phase, there was the implementation phase, and there was reporting. And a lot of times there was a presentation that went with it, along with a technical report that we had to write. So I guess disguised it was project management, but it was never, taught in terms of the words were not there, that what you're doing is project management and you don't have a leader of your team. It's like you're all together. And I don't know. I guess from a college standpoint, no, there wasn't a formal project management training.
But all three of you, or three so far, have emphasized the team effort in school. Did they at least get across to you that when you got out of school, working with teams was going to be so important?
Yeah, they did.
They
said that we would be working. Yeah, they always said, you're going to be working in multidisciplinary teams that are doing different aspects of a project, and that your team may be, you know, focused on one little segment, and that there would be, you know, a person that would be in charge of everything. Although they never really talked about who that person was or what they were like or how they got to where they were.
Okay, great. Dan, do you have anything to add?
Yeah, and I think that, you know, as that's probably the closest we have is this, like, this disguised project management training through, you know, group work. And, you know, generally, as, you know, people in science backgrounds, that's the thing that you want to do least is collaborate in a group, because it's like, oh man, this person's not going to hold their weight, blah, blah, blah. You know, I'd rather just go and do this. I'll knock it out myself tomorrow, you know, tomorrow night and be done with it. And I'll do the whole project. Right. And that's the skill that when you go through your career is probably for science minded people like ourselves, is probably the hardest thing to accomplish. And it was, you know, get good at. And it was disguised all along throughout college, and we didn't just know to take advantage of it and know to step up and do the things. We just did it the way that we would always do it. Lock yourself in your dorm room and get the project done and then pass it off to somebody else, and you're, you know, wipe your hands of it. So it's an interesting progression. So
I'm so glad you said that, Dan. Everybody else mentioned the teams that they used a lot, and that they – it was emphasized when they got out of school, the teams were going to be the way you accomplished your jobs and did work. And nobody said what I was thinking back in school, which was, I hate working on teams. I could do the assignments myself. So I'm glad you brought that up, because even though they're telling you it's your future, when you're doing them, you don't seem to like it. And then you get out, and what makes us like it and want to get into it in our careers is because at that point we see the true value of it. Okay, thanks a lot. That's great. Let's move on. Our third topic in my outline is the practical preparation. And to get into project management, I'm suggesting here some things that you can do. You're not going to sit around doing your job hoping someday somebody taps you on the shoulder and says, do you want to be a project manager? You want to be more proactive about it. So the first thing you do to get into project management is learn about projects by working on projects. Work on project teams. And since your industry is so project-oriented, you're almost doing that by default. But try to get involved with decisions on projects. Speak up at project meetings. Have discussions about one way to do a project versus other ways to do a project. Get involved more than just, I'll do what they tell me to do. Be an active participant in the project team. Then you can take training on project management, either within your company or outside your company. And learn what there is about project management. The classic avenue into being a project manager is to work on a project team, be recognized that you're good at what you do, they promote you to project manager, and then you figure out what project management is on the job. And at some point after that, you take some training and say, oh yeah, that's how it's supposed to be done. But it is mostly common sense, so you can kind of figure it out on your own. And then get certified in project management. And we'll talk about credentialing up ahead. So I just want to turn this over to the panel again, because I think this is what the group is most interested in. When you come to a session like this, what you want to hear is from real project managers who have experience. How did they get into this? So that's the question I want to ask of our panel now. And since the last question was so quick, and the first question was where everyone was stealing Dustin's answers, Let's start with Dustin again.
The thing that comes to my mind here is time. And, you know, you want to, you know, us people who are motivated and interested in the work, think that we look at the clock and we say, you know, why can't it happen faster than that? Why do I need X years? Why do I need X projects, X hours? And the, you know, just again looking backward, of course, that's what comes to mind for me. Essentially, is, you know, I wanted it to happen as fast as possible, and I didn't want to hear the answer as to why it shouldn't happen as fast as possible. Now, in hindsight, now that I've come to mature a bit, I realize that, you know, there are certain experiences that you need to have to go through, and growth periods that are critical to being able to get to certain points of your career. And it's sort of hard to realize that in the moment, and you sort of have just trust your mentors, trust your people above you and your supervisors, and trust that they know best because they've been through it. So that would be my answer on that one, Mark, time.
Okay, thanks a lot. Great. And yeah, that issue that you, if you started your career wanting to get into project management and you can't, that's got to be a big frustration. You have to wait. Okay, Monica?
Right. So I think similar to what Dustin said, sort of antsy to move on, ambition maybe, to move on. And I did start as a field engineer and transitioned fairly predictably through field team lead, task manager, then on to project manager. And then I think that's when I started to figure out what it was to be a project manager. And I think there's an element of you don't know what you don't know. As you're antsy to move through those levels and get to that PM responsibility and then figuring it out, you know, I agree with Dustin. I think it goes back to that time and needing to experience some different things. You know, a project that goes right is a lot different to manage than a project that takes some turns. You don't know what you don't know.
You got to find that out along the way, yeah. Okay, great. Gordon?
Yeah, so I started out, you know, right out of college with my master's degree coursework behind me, but as a, I guess, a underachieving student, I didn't finish my thesis right away. So I had that lingering over my head for the first 4 or 5 years of my career. I would advise anyone that's in the audience listening, don't do that. It's very hard to finish your thesis while you're working. Now, that said, I found my role, you know, as a chemical engineer by training, predominantly working with geologists and field scientists. So I didn't necessarily have a whole lot of peers that were engineers that were, you know, teaching me all the technical stuff. So instead, I was kind of learning the geology technical and not the engineering technical. And, you know, I worked through my career, and, you know, unfortunately, I felt that there was always a glass ceiling that was preventing me from moving into project management. You know, I'd raise my hand and say, hey, I'd like to be a project manager. Hey, how do I get training on that? Hey, how do I get involved in decision making? And time again, it was just no response. It wasn't even no, it wasn't even you're not allowed to, it's just nothing. And for me, that was frustrating, because here I am trying to learn things, I'm trying to expand my horizon, and I'm not getting the support that I needed. My career kind of took a detour a little bit from the technical engineering world, and I went into technical sales for a number of years, and I was working with consultants all across the Mid-Atlantic, looking at in situ remediation technologies that could clean up soil and groundwater. And, you know, for me, that was really important in my career, because I got to talk to engineers and geologists and technical people all the time. And I really learned the communication skills that were needed to be able to collaborate with people, to be able to work through problems on projects and injection projects. And you know, it was humbling sometimes to walk into a room and people were like, "Oh, Gordon, you're so smart," and I'm like, "No, I'm not. I'm really not. I just know this topic very well because I talk about it a lot." And my goal was to try to get them to talk about their experiences. And I think as a project manager, that's really important for us, that we get other people to talk about what their successes are, what their struggles are, how can I help? To me, that's a very important phrase for project management. How can I help? Because if you go from it, if you attack it from the standpoint of, you have a problem, why did you come to me with a problem? If you flip that and said, how can I help, you're identifying they have a problem. But it's no longer confrontational and you're receptive to them. So I think, in my current role, some of those frustrations that I faced as a young professional right out of college, I have influenced how I behave now as, a young professional in project management.
Thank you so much. Two things have come up here that I want to comment on. One is that, Gordon, you're saying you want other people to speak. When I see lists of skills, not characteristics, but I guess it's a characteristic, but really skills for a project manager, number one on the list in terms of communication is usually listening. We're gathering information from our team so we can make decisions. It's more listening than other kinds of communication. That's a very important skill. Listening is very important. And then being the role of helping. You use the word helping. When people say, what's the role of a project manager? A lot of time leader comes to mind. Leader's not really the role of a project manager. Of course, that's part of it, but not the main thing. The number one word that comes up for role of a project manager is facilitator, which goes right along with what you were saying. You're there to facilitate. You're there to help. So thank you. Dan, you want to add something?
Sure. I mean, there's a couple things that I wanted to add, but there's also some questions in here that are pretty good from the Q&A. And one of them was, and this goes along the way of, what's your path to project management? And one of the questions is would you say anyone who manages a contract or a task be in a PM role? And I think that that's something that's important to think about is, as Gordon said, you take on small tasks, you step up and say, how can I help? Can I help with this? Can I help with that? And that's really been the way that my career has taken me, is that, at GZA, we expect people and we encourage people to take on things like that. And it's like, you're not just, as you start your career, you don't go to, from one site to the next site to the next site to do soil sampling. We want people to be able to start with defining the scope of work and putting together a written scope of work, soliciting bids from drilling contractors, for this example, putting together the subcontract agreement, all these things that are part of, the skills that are needed to be a manager. So you're learning along the way those skills, so that when you're 10 or 15 years into your career, then those things come naturally, and you're also training other people to do those tasks as well. So there's less as the project manager to do, and you can rely on younger staff that are progressing throughout the ranks. So that's how kind of I went through it. Is you take on these things earlier on your career, you ask, you volunteer to do things, and from 5 years out of school, you're starting to take on those tasks, and it becomes a natural progression. And that's really important, is to look for those opportunities to manage small things, and then the bigger things become kind of natural.
Okay, terrific. So part of your answer, Dan, is things people can do, but there's a bigger part of your answer that's not really in the hands of younger people to do, and that's, it's the duty or the responsibility of the organization to groom the future project manager. So as younger people, you should be looking, am I working in an organization that is grooming me, setting me up for growth? And if not, you probably want to be in a different organization. Are you working for a boss? Because different bosses are different. Who will serve as a good mentor? Look for one of those. Try to get in that group or on that team. Because if they're proactive about growing their people to be project managers, you will be on the path towards that career development.
When I got my mark, to that end also, like, let's say that you are in a bad situation or in a bad, you know, group. And I use bad as kind of, just a term here. But, you know, let's say you have a mentor that's outside of that group. That's actually great because, you know, you could maybe get input from your mentor on how to improve the group that you are working with. Rather than, like, trying to distance yourself, try to be the person that helps change it and make it a more positive working relationship to, you know, promote everybody within the group instead of having, you know, your teammates maybe not be in a good atmosphere or something that people don't want to be involved with. You know, make your team, you know, one that shines by using outside resources to help you along with that.
Yeah, in my first job for the Army, my boss, my first boss who hired me was, I guess, nearing retirement. And he would go on and on about, I'll use his phrase, where my boys are now. So-and-so's in this position. So-and-so's in this position. His greatest pride in his career was how he developed all these other people's careers. Mm-hmm. And that's the environment that you would hope is set wherever you're working, because you want people doing that for you, and then you pass it forward when you're moving on in your career later. Okay.
So our next Mark, topic real is, quick. Mark, before we move on to credentialing, there was a really good question that came in related to emotional quotient versus or your emotional intelligence versus your intelligency. You know, how technically smart you are about things. And that's something that's hard as a project manager, especially if you have a technical background. You know, you're really good at looking at formulas and data and crunching through numbers. And, you know, that is, by and large, a lot of the work that we do. And we're always reviewing other people's work in some fashion, you know, whether it's from a scope or schedule standpoint, a budget standpoint, understanding what influence that data has on our project. But the one thing that we often miss is how is our staff doing? How are the people that we're working with actually doing and feeling? Do they feel that they're participating? Do they feel that they're being heard? I always like to think of it this way. If you go in a room and you've got 10 people in there and you've got two or three people that are leading the conversation, that means there's 7 people in the room that haven't voiced their ideas. And a lot of times you have to think, people think differently than others. Some people are very fast. You ask them a question, they have an answer. Other people, you ask them a question, you have to wait, because they have to formulate an idea before they can communicate what they were thinking. So it's really understanding what your group dynamics are like, understanding what the personalities in your group are, understanding that a younger professional will probably take longer before starting an answer than a more seasoned professional. And for seasoned professionals, understanding that sometimes they should bite their tongue and allow a junior person to voice something so that they get a seat at the table. And I know that there are, you know, I saw the metrics of ages and years of experience on the call. That's really hard for us to do, especially when we're like the technical expert in the room, to just kind of shut up. That's really hard. The other thing that I've learned is if you're not, if you don't seem like you're getting answers from people or you're not getting them fast enough, it's probably because you're expecting something that's unrealistic. And you might need to count yourself to 7. So you ask your question and you count till 7 and see if an answer comes in. Most people, when they try to do this exercise, they'll say, okay, I asked my question, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. And they just gave the audience 3 seconds of time to formulate an answer and communicate it. I've done a lot of work with youth development through the Boy Scouts. And, you know, when you're dealing with young minds and adolescent minds, sometimes it can take 7, 10, 15 seconds before you get a response. And it comes down to how do you respond to the emotional intelligence of your audience. And we're not, you know, talking about, you know, the psychology and going into all of that. It's just how do people behave? And how do you set that person up to be successful in the role that you're putting them in? Because if you're setting them up for failure, they're going to fail. But if you set them up for something that they can succeed in and that they can do well, and you check in with them and ask them when they have problems and, you know, create an open door for them, they're more likely to be successful, and they're probably going to become a very strong team member. And otherwise, you probably would have lost them because they would have jumped ship and been like, this company's crap. They don't value me. They don't listen to me, and I'm gone.
Yeah. A lot of times we chase our best people away, and we keep the people because they care and they're not listened to, and we keep the people who don't care, and they're the ones we don't care to keep as much. In terms of emotional intelligence, though, that was terrific. I'm not going to add anything to that, Gordon. That was great. But I do want to add something on that subject relevant to something else. Another question someone posted, they said there wasn't enough of that when they were learning about project management and training for their PMP certification, which segues us into credentialing. But I do want to add that the new test for the PMP 2021 and the new materials for that has a whole section devoted just to this topic of emotional intelligence. So the recognition of how important it is growing. As you can see, it's getting incorporated more formally into training and testing and certification and so forth. Okay, so our next topic is the credentialing. And the first question is, why become certified at all? Well, first, I don't have it on here, but first I want to say in every field, no matter what field you're in, there's more and more emphasis now on certification. They're trying to standardize things so everyone has at least some level, and the certification shows that. So the certification doesn't make you a great expert. It doesn't mean you're better than someone who's not certified, but it means you've at least demonstrated some basic level of knowledge that qualifies you for the job. So on average, I think certified project managers are probably better than not certified ones, on average. Any individual cases? Probably not. Maybe not. So why should you become certified? Competitive advantage. Some companies require a certification of project managers. Others don't require it, but if you're being hired as a new project manager, the new people have to have it. Others give preference in assignments to the certified people. you also have situations where people will only hire consultants if they're certified. I was asked to go in on a bid with a company last week because it was in Six Sigma, Lean Six Sigma, and the requirement was that there had to be a master black belt leading the effort, and they didn't have a master black belt. I've worked with these people a lot. They could handle it totally by themselves, but their black belt's not master black belt. Somehow that word on a piece of paper seems to make a difference. You also want to become certified because you can gain skills and knowledge from your work, but you can also gain skills and knowledge from the certification process, the training you have to go through, the things you learn. I'm hoping, I don't know for sure, that we get improved performance from certification. Definitely you get career advancement, and with that comes earning potential. And finally, I guess back to my thing about having the master black belt, professional credibility. I was shocked when I finished my PhD how people listened to me differently. I wasn't any smarter. I wasn't any different than I'd been a month before. But somehow, people just viewed me differently. And when you're certified, people will view you differently. In terms of the certifications out there, there's certifications in project management from the Project Management Institute. From what I can see already, some of you have these, some of you don't. But there's a project management professional. But again, that's for experienced project managers. If you're looking to get into project management, you would say, how could I get certified in project management if I'm not a project manager? The second one here, CAPM, is for you. That's the one I would recommend in this discussion where we're looking to get into project management. This says I've studied project management, I've passed a test on it. No experience is required as a project manager. PMP requires experience. The CAPM, no experience. And when you have that, it's a credential at work, and it shows your interest, and people are going to say, oh, that person is one we should groom. They're looking to get into this. Equivalent to PMI is the International Association for Project Managers. They have their own certification. I like theirs too. It's very practice-oriented. You have to show completed projects and show how you guided a team through. The PMI certifications, you don't have to do that. But you do have to show your experience. And then there's just different agency certifications, which you can get within government agencies or within companies and so forth, that show certifications to project management. So we have some poll questions here. Can we get those up? Because the first one is, how many of you have some certification in project management? And the second is, are you interested in getting such a certification? And also, do you have some other credential? So a lot of you got your PE. That's the first one I got, too, because coming out of engineering school, they emphasized that I get that. I don't remember the date that I passed my PE exam, but I do remember the date that I failed my PE exam because it's my son's birthday and I never showed up for the exam. So we went to the hospital instead. So technically, I failed that. But it looks like most of you have your PE, very few a certification in project management. And again, if you're looking to get into project management, that credential of the CAPM shows your interest and shows that you have the training, you have the education. In terms of, are you interested in getting a certification? Interesting, that's more than three times the number that has it. It's not a majority, but it's more than three times the number that has it here. And then of the certifications listed on the slide, which you're most interested in getting, despite my recommendation of the CAPM, 95% of you are saying PMP. So great, I'm running PMP classes all the time. Just let me know when you're interested. But why aren't you picking CAPM? I'm guessing it's because maybe you have more experience and you're past the CAPM level. You're ready for that PMP. So terrific. Okay. Our next slide discusses the CAPM versus the PMP, but I think I talked about that already. The PMP needs experience as a project manager and 35 hours of training in project management. The CAPM, no experience. Again, you take training and you pass an exam. I was asked to bring up the issue of the changes in the PMP exam. I'm not sure that's so important, but if 95% of you are interested in getting it, maybe it is. So I'm glad I was asked to add this, because I only added this because others asked me for this. The old exam was based on the sixth edition, the sixth version of the PMBOK. If you're looking into this, you know a seventh edition is ready to come out. The new 2021 exam, though, is still based on the sixth. So that's the book to study. The old exam was based on the 10 areas of knowledge, the 49 processes. The CAPM is based on that, too. It's based on the sixth edition. The new exam, while the information comes from the sixth edition, is not based on that 10 areas of knowledge as the main outline and the 49 processes. It's based on a focus of people, process, and business. People at the start to emphasize, like you're telling me today, how important communication is in all this, and managing people, and bringing teams together, and getting the most out of them. Process is really the old test. So that's still the majority of this. And then the business, and that's a growth. Certification in project management used to take the view that I'm a project manager and my goal is to get this project done and nothing else matters. If I get this project done, it doesn't matter what happens with it after. If it's not going to succeed, it's because management didn't pick the right project in the first place, but I did the one they told me to do. Now we're saying let's expand that and let's consider how it fits into the business a little more. So that's another area of growth. So it's away from process in those two directions. It also follows more of a life cycle flow. Initiate the project, plan the project, execute the project, close out the project. Whereas the old test was based on the 10 areas of knowledge, which was separate from life cycle. Just 10 things we're interested in. Okay, so I want to ask the panel what professional certifications you have in project management or in others related to your field. Let's start with Dan again.
Sure. So I definitely don't have my PMP or my construction management credentials either. I mean, I've gone through my career with the PE and worked off of that, and my experience has really been, or my training has been on-the-job training and experience in that way. And I think that that's, it's, I would say, the older style of doing things. I wish that when I was younger, I think, number one, knew about the fact that there was this credentialing. And I think that that would have gone a long way in not necessarily getting me there instantly, because this whole process of, moving on and stepping up to and learning the skills of project management isn't just by taking a test, it's learning. But at least it gives you the fundamentals. You focus on those fundamentals early on in the career, and you're aware of more of the things that you need to be focusing on as you move forward. It's not just technical. So I think that that would have been helpful in maybe kind of making me focus on different things earlier on my career and made it an easier transition from being a technical person to being more of the manager.
Okay, great. Thank you. Gordon?
Yeah, so I kind of had the interesting career that I'm trained as a chemical engineer. I have a master's degree in environmental engineering. I was hired to do environmental consulting, which environmental consultants by nature don't necessarily need a PE license. You know, a lot of the work that we do, we don't stamp. And in Pennsylvania, the state that I work in, it's actually a professional geologist that stamps reports. It's not a professional engineer that stamps reports. So, you know, being able to stamp documents as a PE was never important for me. But now that I'm, you know, further in my career, it's kind of like, well, I probably should have got that credential. I should have gone through that. And, you know, I look back and I say, well, no one really taught me or, you know, helped me understand how to apply for the PE, for the PE exam and get my licensor. No one told me about the importance of working for a supervising PE, because I only had that for about 4 years of my career out of the 14 years that I've been working. So how do I go and get my PE now when I don't have a supervising PE? I'm not working, you know, on technical designs and things like that. So my normal, you know, technical skill set, like when's the last time I used calculus? It was over a decade ago. Would I be able to even sit for the PE, or do I need to learn a whole bunch of new things? So that kind of took me to where I am today, that I do a lot of project management, and I said, well, that's a no-brainer for me. I have plenty of experience managing projects. Why don't I go for the PMP? You know, I've been doing that my whole career now. So, Mark, you'll be very proud. I signed up for the PMP prep course today.
Oh,
so great. That is step one of getting my PE. I have to take my 36 hours of PMP prep class time, and then I can begin my application and put down my experience, and then if that's approved, then I can sit for the exam. So, you know, the PMP was a little bit more straightforward in terms of how do I go about getting that, whereas the professional engineer license still is kind of up in the air, because it's like who signs off as a supervising PE for the projects that I've done. I don't know. I don't have that answer. I would love if people gave me that answer. And you know, that's me, you know, 14 years in my career, and I still don't have that answer.
That's great that you're doing that. If I could make one recommendation, you said you're going to take the training and then fill out the application. Start filling out the application right from the minute the training starts so that you could submit it as soon as it's done, because you want to take the test fairly soon after the training's done before you start to forget things.
Okay.
Yeah,
we've
Monica?
Got about good, Monica.
Sure. That's good discussion. My take is going to be a little bit different, I think. When you opened the panel, Mark, you had a question about what it meant to be a project manager, and someone responded that it was empowerment. And I identify a little bit more with that when I was thinking about what we prepped us with these questions in advance. You know, what does a professional certification mean to me in my organization? I'm a licensed engineer. I'm not a PMP or a CAPM, but I would encourage anybody get whatever you're eligible for. I think that credentialing of some sort is empowering. In my organization, with the clients that I am often supporting, having my PE license means that I'm signing my own documents and designs and reports as a project manager. And if someone else needs to be involved with a project with sufficient engagement to claim responsible charge, am I really the project manager? Am I really directing the project if I have to have somebody else sign off that it was done properly? So that's what it means to me, truly being able to run my own projects.
Okay, great, thank you. And Dan? Oh, I'm sorry, Justin?
I was just going to give it back to Dan if you want to go again. I'm kidding. I definitely see value in it, Mark. And I really, to me, I think it's a never stop learning mentality is obviously critical for our career and our industry. Aside from that, I think that there, you know, from what I'm gathering and sort of reflecting on is that there's definitely a it's sort of an art, a lot of this, you know, soft skill stuff, some of the emotional intelligence stuff we're talking about, but there's a science that can go into the art. You know, there's you know, studying that, I think, and dedicating time to it should be more in the, you know, the forefront of the minds of leadership these days. I think that, you know, obviously there's a very good reason there isn't. I mean, there's what I need to put on my proposal or the certifications and the, you know, engineers or geologists that I need to do my work. There's, again, maybe it's happening more, a little bit more so very recently, but by and large, you know, PMP is not a certification that I need to put on my proposal to, you know, be on my team to lead my job. So that's obviously, I think, where people are coming back to this and saying, you know, why should I, so what? But the people that I know have gotten the certification and sort of what I've also just come to experience and, you know, just the conversations I've had at SCME events in the past and certainly on this panel as well, it's, you know, it's just sort of it's a refined practice. And you can tell the people who are understanding the way to communicate and are truly polished versus some of the ones like myself who are just faking it until they make it.
Okay, yeah, thank you very much. I'm glad you brought up the art and the science, because when I'm doing project training, it's usually experienced project managers, and I bring this up as a caution. I tell them I'm teaching really more of the science. Don't set aside what you already bring to the table, which is the art, the develop what you've learned on your own and the way you handle things personally. You have to combine those two. Okay, great. Thank you very much. So we see that most people are seeing value in the credentialing, and whether they have it or not. A couple of people on our panel said they don't feel a need for it in their job. I might caution there that if you ever want to switch jobs, it would help you do that. If you're very happy where you are and there's no need to get it in your own job, that's true. Somebody put in the discussion, do I need to have a PMP? Do I need to be certified to be a project manager? Somebody put in there, do I need to get continuing education hours? They call them PDHs. The PMI calls it PDUs, but whatever we call them, to stay a project manager. Yes, you need them to stay certified, but you don't need them to stay a project manager. That's your boss's decision. Okay, the last thing I want to get to is just the major tools of project management. You see, I've listed them here. Sorry, I skipped the slide. Skipped two slides. Oh, okay. And the first of those tools is the work breakdown structure. So let me ask, how many of you use the work breakdown structure? I'm thrilled that there are zero no's to this answer. So if anybody didn't chime in yet, don't put a no there. almost 100% are saying yes. The others are uncertain. I'm willing to bet that you do this, but you're uncertain because you don't use that name. Because you can't start the work without saying, here's the things we have to do. So the work breakdown structure is the foundational tool. It's the one that says, here's what we have to do. Now, how do we schedule it? How do we budget it? And how do we resource it and everything else? This has to be first. And usually people will hold up funding until they see one of these. Because they want to see that what they hope is going to be done is actually going to be done. My next question was, how many of you use Critical Path? And again, very high. This is the most important concept in project management. The critical path defines how long the project will take. That's okay. That's not why it's the most important. But you probably on your projects have hundreds, more likely thousands, of tasks, of work packages that have to be accomplished. There's projects with tens of thousands of work packages. How are any of us as project managers supposed to keep on top of all those things? And the critical path says you don't have to. Because if the critical path is done on time, the project is done on time. Everything else can be late. And if you have 1,000 tasks on your project, maybe 10 or 20 will be critical. 980 or 990 don't have to be done on time, and you don't have to pay as much attention. In other words, it makes our jobs easier. That's why it's the most important concept. And I didn't state it strongly enough when I said 10 or 20 tasks are critical. Because remember, it's a path. They're in sequence. So at any given time, only one of those is happening. So what I want to say is if you ever show up for work as a project manager and you don't know today, on that day, what is that one thing that has to be done on time, you're not doing your job. Concentrate on that one thing. Don't get sidetracked to all these other things that don't matter as much. It's a matter of focus. So again, I'm glad to see that almost everybody here is using Critical Path in their schedules. I'm a little surprised at how many people are using Earned Value. I always emphasize Earned Value as an important tool. I have a one-day class on Earned Value. I try to push it everywhere I go, but most people don't use it. So I'm a little surprised that the majority here are using it, but maybe I shouldn't be surprised because the federal government requires Earned Value reporting on their projects. And many of your types of projects are associated with government, federal government. But just let me sum up what Earned Value is real quickly. It's a way of stating project status, and it does it with just two numbers. Those two numbers represent your status on schedule and your status on budget. So as of today, how am I doing? Earned Value sums it up. Work breakdown structure and critical path are very important, but that's to plan a project. This is the tool you use throughout the project, Earned Value, for tracking how you're doing against the baseline. So those are the three tools there, and we saw that they are mostly in use on your projects. So I'm very happy to hear that. I had one other set of tools, and I just want to go through them very briefly. This is my last slide. One's called the Responsibility Assignment Matrix. For each of those hundreds or thousands or ten thousands of tasks that have to be done, you want a name on each one, and that's what this does. You want to know who to contact, who's responsible. So this is a tool that helps me see how to manage my project I know who to go to for each of those. Let me skip the S-curve for a minute. The quality plan. What are you going to do along the way within your project to make sure, whether it's testing or whatever, that at the end, the quality is there and everything's right? So there's final testing, but there's probably testing along the way. I'm sure many of your projects, most of your projects, require procurement from vendors for materials and other things, consulting too. You have to have a procurement plan for that. I very seldom see a communication plan. I know we said that's the most important thing, communication. Usually people leave it informal. But the more you could think through in advance what you need to communicate to who and when and why and so forth and how, and put that in a document, communication plan is a tool of project management. The next two go along with each other, risk register and issue log. In the beginning of a project, you should be listing what are all the risks associated with the work you're doing. What are all the things that could happen to threaten the achievement of your objectives, your goals? And then you list all those in your risk register, you analyze them in your risk register, you prioritize them in the risk register, and you list things you could do to mitigate those risks in your risk register. And you also can list risk responses, you know, what you're going to do if they happen. Don't wait to think of that when they happen. Think of it in advance. So the risk register is a tool that you bring out at every project meeting, because at every project meeting, you're updating the risk issues and discussing what risks you're facing between now and the next meeting. The issue log is very similar. They say it's a risk before it happens. It's an issue after it happens. So when something happens, it goes in the issue log. And of course, we assign it to someone, have an action plan, and follow up on it to make sure that it's rectified. Let me go back to the one I skipped, and that's the S-curve. The S-curve is your budget baseline, your cost baseline. It's saying how much money have you spent up until any time in the project. So you're supposed to start slow and then go through the execution phase when you're spending most of your money, so it goes up faster. And at the end of the project, it slows down a bit again, and that's why it forms an S. So that's where the name comes from. It doesn't have to be that shape, but more often than not, it is. The S-curve is in your project plan. Throughout the project, you're saying, well, how much did I spend by today? And you're drawing a second S-curve, which is the actual, to see how it compares against the baseline S-curve, see how you're doing on budget. If you're using earned value, you know that there's a third S-curve that you do on schedule as well, but mostly it's considered budget. Someone, I think it was Monica, mentioned the Gantt chart. The Gantt chart is the picture of your schedule that comes out of critical path. There's something called a tracking Gantt chart that you use throughout the project. You keep updating by probably coloring in how much you've done in the bars on the Gantt chart to show your status on schedule. The S-curves for cost and schedule do a similar thing, but of course they add cost. So two ways to track your progress and your performance during the project. Okay, that's all I wanted to discuss. I wanted to leave some time at the end to open it up for questions, either questions of me or questions from individuals on the panel. So what questions do we have?
All right, thank you, Mark. This is Jean, and I'm going to go through and read through some of the questions that have come in. You and your panelists have done a good job kind of watching that queue and addressing some of them as you were discussing. But here's one that came in. There was an earlier comment that if I'm managing a contract, doesn't that really make me a project manager just by the nature of the work? But we did have an observation that contract language and law should probably be taught in some of these project management programs or credentials, because a lot of time the project managers are being tasked with drafting or enforcing those contracts, and that can have a huge impact on how the project is performed. They go on to, you know, dispute resolutions and payments and withholding because of poor performance. And they just note that they're often tasked with arguing contracts and enforcing them despite no legal training. So I don't know if you can talk a little bit about what contract language or law is part of project management education.
Certainly in the PMP training, one of those 10 areas that we discussed is procurement. And you see I have the procurement plan here. So contracting is discussed there. There's a separate PMBOK from the one we usually talk about, which is devoted to construction. They have an extra chapter at the end devoted just to that subject, dealing with claims and things. So it is part of project training, not completely legal aspects. We do leave that up to our legal departments, but we have to be familiar enough with the terminology that they use and the basics of contracting. Certainly, what type of contract you select is in our hands, whether it's cost plus or fixed price, things like that, and the terms we have, whether there's bonuses or penalties built in, very common in projects. Anyone on the panel have anything to add to that?
My experience is, so I've taken some project management training classes and short courses, and, you know, I think all of them that I've taken, they've all kind of touched on it and have exercises and training, and it's the awareness that's important. The other thing that you have to rely on is, you know, what do you have as far as your resources on your team? So, you know, in our company, we have an in-house legal counsel. We have in-house people that do contracts and insurance and things like that, you know, and they're at our disposal. Sometimes your client has an attorney that is linked into the team and you have access to them. So understanding the pieces that you have available to you on your team is sometimes very important. And, you know, you can really gain a lot of insight from those individuals to help you through certain situations when you're in uncharted territory that's, you know, maybe going towards a claim or issues with insurance or, you know, calling a bonding company or something like that. So, you know, you have to know what's on your team and what resources you have available. You know, I don't think just being a project manager or being a vice president of a company is going to give you the all-knowing knowledge to navigate through those challenges.
Yeah, I agree. That's great. Thank you.
And Dan, I'd second on that. I mean, I'm lucky at UGI that, you know, we have in-house counsel, we have external counsel, we've got a procurement department, we've got through our UGI corporate, we've got kind of another layer of procurement and insurance and risk management. And, you know, there are a lot of people that, you know, we can leverage their talent and their knowledge. I think on the project management side, it's really having the awareness of if things start deviating or things start getting uncomfortable or, you know, for us, a big thing is health and safety violations. What recourse do you have as a project manager and the project owner to dismiss a client, or how do you, you know, reward good behavior? Is it that, you know, they get shortlisted on future bids? Like, what are those things that are allowed to be done? And a lot of times it comes from having open communication with procurement, with legal, with all those different team members, that you can approach them, you can talk through things, and they see that as a value that you're coming to the table with ideas and you're talking about them, instead of being in the other category that you now have problems and you haven't had any discussions, and now, you know, you're the one that's bringing bad news, and it can get really hairy fast, depending on what that bad news is.
Okay, yeah, great. Thank you. Gene, are there any other, like, groups of questions that kind of go together that we could talk about in our last minute or two?
Yeah, I'm going to go into two groupings of questions. So I'll just say that we've had a number of people commenting and making observations, since we do have a lot of federal employees live on the session, that they are working in roles that are managing projects. They may even have the title project manager in their job title, but that their agency or their the government group that they work for does not require credentialing. So it's just an observation that they're recognizing that they're being called project managers, but they are not being encouraged or asked to go get this type of credentialing. And several of them have followed on and asked, and this has also come from some of the private sector participants, does securing one of these certifications increase your professional worth? In other words, can they count on getting more money if they go get a certification?
There's lots of surveys on that that shows PMPs make more than other project managers on average. But in individual cases, you can't say that at all, no. But on average, yes. So that makes it worth it. You heard from our panel that they're at the point in their career where they're experienced project managers, and they see no need for themselves to get certified because it's not going to add anything in their job. And that's true. You're a project manager because you're a project manager, not because you got certified as one.
Mm-hmm.
So when the government agencies are not requiring them to be project managers, to be certified, that doesn't take away in any way from the fact that they're project managers. They might be managing billion-dollar projects, for all I know, and be among the best project managers in the world. They just never decided to take a test.
Right.
So that's not an issue. The issue is that there is a trend in it towards certification, and that it has value for that reason too, not just increased salary.
And Martin, some companies, from my perspective, get to that. Go ahead, Gordon.
Yeah, go ahead. Oh, I'll go. All right. One of the things that drove me to take the PMP or start that process was I don't know what I don't know. So through credentialing, there's a baseline of what you should know to be a project manager through the PMP. And I said, I've managed a lot of projects. I do a lot of that. But what don't I know? What other tools are out there that I've just never been shown because I didn't have a mentor that showed that tool to me? So really, credentialing gives you that exposure. And it seems like the way that the PMP is structured is that you have coursework that you have to do beforehand so that you can have that opportunity to learn and to know what else is out there. Then you have to become proficient in that knowledge so that you can pass a test to say, yes, I'm proficient as a project manager. So that was kind of my way of thinking about the PMP. I think it's a little bit different than a PE or some other credential where it's saying that, yes, you've amassed enough knowledge. I think the PMP, it's helping you to know what your blind spots are.
And remember, PE is like a legal thing. You can't sign documents without it. There's nothing requiring anyone to have a PMP. Can I address one question first? It's not even a question. Somebody posted that clients are demanding earned value analysis. And I said most people are doing it because this federal project, the federal government requires it. Whether your government is your client or someone else, if you're doing it because the clients demand it, I guess it's still useful. But remember, if you're driving a car, you want the dashboard that signals all the information that's generated for you where you could see it, correct? You don't want the dashboard of your car in somebody's house somewhere so they can monitor your driving and you don't see any of the information. Similarly, earned value is reporting to you how you're doing on your project. So it shouldn't be just for your client. It should be more for yourself. It helps you steer the ship. Okay, I just wanted to make that point because that's one of my things I'm always pushing. Jean, go ahead.
Sure. We did have some people asking If you have suggestions, ideas, language, ways to approach management who may not be supportive in pursuing a project management certification?
Well, okay.
I think that for each individual, you know, and each individual company, it's different. But I would hope that the trend in most companies, number one, is to go towards credentialing in some way, shape, or form. But you know, individuals should really have a mentor and have a roadmap for getting to where they want in their career, and an advocate for them. So it's not a one-sided, I'm going to go to the office manager and he's going to either check the box that I can get this course approved and this credentialing approved or not. You know, enlist other people, enlist your supervisors or mentors to be your advocate, to help make that a discussion point, not for, just I'm going in by myself, but I'm going in for a reason, and this is where I want to take my career, and understand that with your supervisors and mentors to help you with that.
Yeah, great.
Dan, I'm probably on.
Go ahead.
Project manager 101 to be persistent, essentially. I'm going to keep talking and just be persistent over everyone right now. I think that this is a good example for essentially, you can't take no for an answer, right? You have to continue to go back to the people who tell you no, and keep presenting the argument and stay persistent. And if there really is value to that, people will relent. You know, don't just try once, and it's not a one and done type of thing. I think that's a really important theme that jives here pretty well with the certification.
If you have, if you have a no on the certification from your boss, they don't value the certification. They do value personal growth and personal development, so you could sell it from that angle too. I'm sorry, Gordon, go ahead.
Yeah, and I was going to offer that, that this conference itself is hosted by the Society of American Military Engineers. They're one of many professional societies that are in our orbit. Professional societies are a great way to possibly talk to your boss in a outside environment, so not in your corporate environment. It's also an opportunity to meet other professionals that can become your mentors and your advocates, and they can help you along your path. There are a lot of other ways that you can gain growth. I know that for me, leadership development largely came from professional society. It didn't necessarily come from my company. And when I asked for project management experience, I was told no. And when I was told that I was going to be promoted to an assistant project manager, that was taken away from me. So it was like all these different head games that were happening in the corporate America. But on the professional side, professional societies are really about developing and mentoring and coaching young minds so that they can be the leaders of the organization in the future. So I'd advocate that, anyone that isn't seeing, a growth opportunity or mentoring and coaching within your organization, go outside. There are plenty of people that want to mentor and coach you.
All okay, right. Jean, anything else?
Last quick question I'm going to sneak in here. Mark, is there a little cheat sheet or a booklet that project managers should have at their desk for reference that kind of reminds them of the different tools and methods available to be applying on their projects?
From my Six Sigma experience, I know there's a company, I think they're in Boston, I think it's called Goal QVC, that puts out what they call a memory jogger, has all the little tools in a little book you can put in your pocket. I think they have one for project management. So that might be useful. Other than that, there are some, there's tons of books on project management, but there's some that are smaller and, that you keep more as a desktop reference. But the real reference is the PMBOK, although that's not very readable and it's very long. That's everything you would need right there.
Okay. Well, I think we are just coming to the possible end time that I have for your panel. So Mark, Monica, Dan, Gordon, Dustin, I just want to thank each and every one of you for having a fabulous session to close out our virtual symposium today. So if you all could give me a wave goodbye so that you know we are moving on in the audience when you exit the stage. I'm going to change a few things here on the screen and walk through a few final reminders as we begin our closeout comments for today's session. So everybody stick with me. Don't leave. Remember, I promised you some important reminders at the end of our session today, and I'm going to follow through with those reminders. So the first thing that I want to be sure to do is send a great big thank you to our event sponsors. Again, without their support, this event would not have happened. I also want to thank our large business sponsors, as well as our small business sponsors, again, for helping to make this virtual symposium happen. One of the other things I'll remind everybody is that this virtual symposium is just one of many events that DCHWS hosts throughout the year. The group is planning to carry on with its West Symposium, hoping to be in person in the fall of 2021 out in Denver, Colorado. So they're looking to push out abstracts in the late summer this year. So we encourage you to visit the DCHWS website. I put that in the Q&A window to learn more. And then, of course, we have an ongoing partnership here at EPA through the Cleanup Information Network, or CLUIN, where we continue to host bi-monthly webinars highlighting technical presentations. And so I put into the Q&A window as well our upcoming schedule. And if you can't read that, I'll just remind you all that we've got three of them scheduled. We had to postpone one, so the next one will be taking place on April 28th, and then we'll have two hosted on May 12th. These are all free and available to those who'd like to register to participate through our CLUIN.org website. Now, let's get into the one thing I'm sure you're all hanging on for, certificates and credits. And so I'll explain a few things for our sessions today. For each and every CLUIN webinar, we make an option available upon submitting feedback for the event to either print out or download a participation certificate after you fill out feedback. So for the virtual symposium, you all have access to the seminar homepage. It was the same homepage for every day of the virtual symposium. And along those tabs on the homepage, there's a feedback form tab. So you can go to the same page that you used when checking in for today's live event and just click on that feedback form. And on the top, you'll see options to pick the date of the symposium that you'd like to provide feedback. So you can give feedback for each day that you attended. You can fill this form out multiple times as needed. It is very important when you are done filling out the feedback form that you check the box at the bottom certifying you were here for the whole thing and that you would like a certificate. If you don't check that box, a certificate will not be issued. But if you do check the box and then hit the submit button, you should then immediately have access to a certificate for each day that you fill that form out for. It looks something like this. And you can save this for your own records. Again, this is only for you as a participant to keep track of the sessions that you've shared feedback and attended. This certificate, as many of you have been quick to point out to me, does not list PDHs. And that is because I am unable to issue PDHs via CLUIN. But Sammy and your event PDH sponsors will be issuing those PDHs to you for the individuals who registered and participated in the live event. So as we conclude our virtual live symposium, I'll be working to pull all of the participation logs for all 3 days, and I'll be sharing that information with Sammy and our PDH event sponsors so that they can work to get those PDH hours available, and they will share information on the PDHs you have earned in a follow-on email. So those CLUIN participation certificates that you get when you fill out our event feedback form are really there for you and your own records. And for those of you looking for PDHs, those will come afterwards from Sammy and our event PDH sponsors. So I apologize if that was not clear to everyone. I will also be sending a follow-up email to all registrants explaining this as well. So if you had to hop off early, you will get an explanation email from me on this process. And I will also remind everyone that I'll be checking in through my records. So if we happen to note that you did not participate on any given day, you will each get an email from me in the next day, just confirming that noted that we don't have a record of you checking in on this day of the symposium. Is that correct? Or if not, you can click here to correct your check-in information. So if you don't get any emails from me, then we have you fully logged as participating on all 3 days, and you should get those PDH emails shortly. If not, you'll get an email from me in the next day with opportunities to correct your participation information. So with that, I want to thank our panelists, our DCHWS planning committee members. I want to thank all of our moderators. I want to thank all of the event sponsors, the technical support staff that were assisting in the background. And I also want to thank each and every one of you who participated in this 3-day online event. It has truly been a great privilege to be here and be part of this session with you and see all of the great technical information and exchange that took place. I really do hope to virtually see you all on a future session. And with that, I will go ahead and officially conclude our virtual symposium. And thank you all again.